Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 167. That's a lot of episodes. Unfortunately, John Lindeman could not be with us today. He's helping his wife with something, so he'll be back next time, I believe. And in his place, we actually have the founder of Nintendo World Report a long, long time ago, Billy Berghammer.
What's up? How you doing?
Very, very glad to have you, sir. Star of the stage and screen and radio.
Oh, whatever. Oh, no. I think Lindeman's waxing his head, actually.
He's using some of those Gillette products that Matty Ice has been promoting so thoroughly.
It's true. He's got a shiny dome. What can you say?
So, yeah, we're very happy to have Billy here. And we've got, actually, on this episode, of course, new business. And in the middle, we're going to have a really interesting feature, I think, on difficulty in gaming. Then we'll wrap up with your listener mail and get caught up on that a little bit. So to start off, as usual, we let the guests go first, and I'd like to hear more about what Billy's been playing.
I've been playing a lot of stuff now that I'm kind of free from my job responsibilities, kind of been able to focus on a lot of the big holiday releases that have been coming out on a regular basis. So blew through ODST solo, and I quite enjoyed it. I thought ODST was fun. I haven't played through a co-op yet, and I'm kind of interested in doing that in the next couple of weeks. I think it's a nice change of pace from Bungie. I like the world that they built for ODST. I like the fact that you aren't Master Chief, and the second you try going in balls out like Master Chief, you are going to be in some trouble. We'll just put it that way.
Okay, because I had heard that it's played more like Halo than you might think.
Oh, it totally feels it feels like Halo, but I mean, you can run and gun, but I mean, since you don't have rechargeable shields, you need to go find health packs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You will run out of ammo. So, I mean, it all depends on what difficulty setting you played on, but really early on in the first level, I found myself going, "Oh crap. I need to find cover. I need to go find health packs and figure out strategies on how to get from point A to point B, because that's basically what you're doing."
So you feel like it's more deliberative than a regular Halo game?
Oh yeah, totally.
Okay.
And I found it a little bit more challenging. I mean, it's not overly difficult. I haven't played it on Heroic yet, but you know, I'm hoping to grab a couple more people and play it cooperatively and really bump up the difficulty. But I found it enjoyable. It's short, but I think it's pretty cool. And one of the best soundtracks I've ever heard in a video game.
I've heard a lot about the music.
It's so good. Marty O'Donnell did a hell of a job, and it's fantastic. I still need to pick up a copy of that. And last week, the big game was Uncharted 2. I blew through that like in a day and a half, and well, actually, two sittings. I got some free time. that is probably going to be my game of the year, depending on how a couple other games pan out for the rest of the year. But honestly, it's just a summer blockbuster from start to finish. You know, it's not 100% perfect. I mean, it's got a few flaws, but overall, the story, the action, they really did couple the hand-to-hand combat well with the shooting mechanics. The cover system is still a little janky here and there, but for the most part, it's solid, and it's really, really a lot of fun. You know, I said, I played it through it in two sittings, but that's because you don't want to put the controller down. You want to know what happens, and it's really fantastic. The multiplayer is okay. I've played it quite a bit just because I wanted to level up and try some of that, but overall, I think the cooperative stuff in Uncharted is really good. I really, really enjoyed it.
So I have a question for you about Uncharted 2, and this is something that we talked to John about last week, and we've gotten some emails about it. I've heard a lot of conflicting views on this, so I want your take on it.
All right.
Greg and I just got PS3s for the first time when the price drop in the Slim came through.
Nice.
And neither of us have played the first Uncharted yet. It's on my Gamefly queue, so I'm just waiting for it, basically. Do you think it's worth playing through the first one before you play 2?
Absolutely. I think, first off, Uncharted 1 is really good. There were issues that they resolved for Uncharted 2, but I think, and I actually played that game in one sitting. Like, that was just like a woke up early morning on a Sunday, brewed a pot of coffee, and just blew all the way through it. and it's a lot of fun. Plus, now you got trophies with it too. So, not if you're a trophy person or not, whatever. That being said, it's really enjoyable. It, for me, it totally harkens back to Romancing the Stone, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that sort of thing. And the characters are great, and I think, especially with the story and the characters that come from the first game into the second game, I think it's important. And it's not that, hell, you could pick it up used, I'm sure, pretty cheap. It's a good game to have in your collection for sure.
Okay.
So, and then starting Borderlands tonight, so look very much looking forward to that.
Yeah. Now, I know you haven't been playing any Nintendo games recently, and that's not uncommon among a lot of people I've talked to. A lot of people seem to think it's been kind of a dry season lately, but what are you looking forward to this holiday season for from Nintendo or for Wii and DS?
Well, actually, the last Nintendo game I'd say I'd played was Muramasa, which I thought was kind of a letdown. Like, I think it's really beautiful. The team is really done a great job with that game, and it is very, very, very Japanese, but I think it's almost... This is going to sound terrible because I'm a big lover of, like, Japanese-style games, but it's almost too Japanese.
Yeah.
Just the stopping and talking to every person, like, it just gets kind of boring, but the combat, I think, is really exciting and a lot of fun. The bosses are awesome. The art style is amazing. You know, I think those guys did a great job, but I guess I don't know if I will go back and actually try to finish it, so...
Yeah. I played at Muramasa for like 3 or 4 hours, and I felt like that was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I felt like I had gotten a pretty good slice of it, and just didn't really feel like seeing any more of it. I mean, I think it's a game that it's extremely well made, very, very polished, very, very well produced, and I feel like Muramasa is a game that is going to blow away a very small section of the population. You know, like, it's built for a very, very, very specific audience.
Sure.
And those people will go absolutely nuts for it. And everybody else will respect it. But you probably won't get into it. You probably won't get sucked into it for 20 hours, you know?
I guess, personally, I was hoping for more from that. But as far as on the Nintendo side, you know, the games that I'm really looking forward to this holiday season, obviously Mario. I am totally waiting to get my hands on that. I already have three people lined up that we're going to blow through it. You know, we were actually talking about it last night at a friend's birthday party that we want to just marathon it and try to go front to back in like a 24-hour period.
Oh, that probably won't be too hard.
I don't think it'll be too hard, but I mean, you never know. I mean, they say that it's going to be challenging. I think, and the last time I played it was at PAX, which I still think was the same E3 build.
Mm-hmm.
Playing the harder levels with four players is not an easy feat. Like, it's...
No.
And
no.
I I'm just, like, imagining, like, if they go to, like, the traditional, like, 8 worlds, 4 levels per world, like, the 8th world is going to be a total bitch. And there's going to be the 3 people that fail out, and there's going to be that one guy that you're hoping on that will get all the way through. So
that's true.
I'm very much looking forward to that. Sin and Punishment, bring that. I want it so bad.
Yeah, it's like, coming out. It's coming out. It'll be about less than a week away in Japan by the time this goes out.
Greg has a clock.
damn right, I've got a clock. I've had this pre-ordered for a while.
He's already asked for the time off.
Seriously.
Unfortunately, we're in the grip of a postal strike over here.
It's
going to take to get.
Damn it.
I'm so stoked for that.
You're going to have to hitch a cab to Scotland and have it sent there or something. You
might have to go to France, actually.
Yeah, I was really excited when they announced it. I was actually pretty surprised. And
yeah.
I'm glad the game, you know, the first Sin and Punishment was finally released in the States, especially since it was completely localized and then they never released it for the N64.
Yeah.
Like, it was ready to go and Nintendo just sat on it, which was stupid because there was so much hype behind that game when they showed that initially at, God, Space World 99 or 2000 or whatever. So, you know, I'm glad that there is going to be a sequel, another niche title probably, yeah, so be it. I don't care. I'm going to be part
of
that.
Billy, do you remember the first time that we saw Sin and Punishment? You might have played it at a Space World. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was there when
the first time I saw it was at E3 in Max's hotel room, Max Lake.
Okay.
And he had it running. And I guess he had imported it. I don't think it was your copy. I think it was his copy. And he was playing the first level of it. And I was just mesmerized.
Yeah.
I thought, whoa. And he let me play it. And I was
single tear.
And then you went to TGS or Space World later that year. It must have been TGS. That was after Space World ended. And you sent me, you brought back a copy for me, which was like one of the best gifts I ever got.
Space World. That was actually the last Space World, and that was right before the GameCube launch in Japan.
Yeah, so. 2001. Yeah, because Sin and Punishment was the end of 2000 is when it came out. So God. It had been out at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
The most expensive imported game I ever bought was Sin and Punishment 1, and I think just to get a rush delivery, because it came out like right around Thanksgiving, I paid like $120 for it. Just because I wanted,
probably paid
so
almost
bad.
That much for my copy when you were in Japan. Because by then it was already a collector's item, even like less than a year later.
Actually, your copy was like 2,500 yen. Like it was discounted
Holy
at that point
shit.
because the,
are you serious?
Yeah. Because the GameCube was just about to come out, and you know everybody in Japan was pretty much over the 64 at that
PS2
point.
PS2 would
so.
Have been out by then, and obviously Dreamcast had been out for a while, and you know the N64
Dreamcast
was on its
been
knees.
On about 2 years then.
I'm pretty excited for Sin and Punishment 2. I'm looking forward to actually firing up the Wii and doing something with it, and then then you have Zelda. That's going to be great.
So no third party stuff though for the rest of the year. I mean, there's not that much still coming out. A lot of the interesting stuff has come out in the past month or two.
Yeah, Boy and His Blob was probably one of the bigger ones for me, and that just came out in America. It's yet to come out in Europe.
Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but it's high on my list.
Well, and some of the other stuff is it like right after the holidays and into like January and stuff.
Oh, the spring is going to be crazy.
There's lots of stuff. I mean, it's the season, you know. I mean, granted, a lot of really big games that were supposed to come out in Q4 got pushed into Second Christmas, which is, you know, early next year. You know, Call of Duty, I'm super ready for that. I think that's going to be obviously a big game. And starting Borderlands tonight, I've got a couple friends that have already been playing it for a while.
Oh, I've seen Bloodworth been playing it for like 2 weeks. He must have been reviewing it or something.
Yeah, he probably. You know, it's mixing two genres that I really enjoy, which is kind of your World of Warcraft leveling up sort of cooperative play with a crap ton of guns, and the action's great. I went to Gearbox right around QuakeCon, and you know, got to talk to Randy about the game and check the game out firsthand, and you know, it's really enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to getting into the trenches and seeing what they've pulled off.
I don't have much interest in Borderlands, but I do like the art style. I like the cel-shaded kind of stuff.
Yeah, they did a really good job, and I'm hoping it does well for them. You know, the critics seem to like it. Gearbox is due for a solid hit.
Yeah. All right, Greg, you're up next, and I guess you've got an update on some stuff from last week.
Well, yeah, so I did buy Kirby Superstar for the Japanese Virtual Console, as I talked about maybe doing last week. I've been playing a bit of that. It's very easy to go in and sort of drop in and play a little bit of that with Virtual Console. It's really nice and casual kind of thing to dip into compared to most of the other things that are on my Japanese Wii, like it's Ghouls and Ghosts, Castlevania 3, and all that kind of stuff. So, because it is very gentle, but...
Nice.
That's the perfect word, actually, for Kirby.
It is.
Gentle.
It really is. But one thing I hadn't sort of picked up on just from my limited exposure to the game when it came out is that Kirby and the enemies retain the sort of hand-drawn kind of look that you expect from them. But all the environments and stuff is all done with the pre-rendered style, which is very popular at that point in the mid-90s.
I lost that by playing it on DS, because on DS I think the art style is far more consistent between the characters and the environments and everything.
That's what I was going to say. It is a little bit inconsistent in that regard.
Well,
it's quite interesting.
I think it's also because it's maybe because it's smaller and shrunk down. You might not notice it as much either.
But, well, no, they redid the art quite a bit for the DS version. Yeah.
Mm. So yeah, I found that quite interesting, because the funny thing is that another relatively recent game that I bought on the Japanese Virtual Console was Earthworm Jim 2, and that does very much the same thing, because obviously Jim is, you know, this cartoon character, and he's really, you know, sort of fluidly animated and all that. He's meant to look like a traditional cartoon character, but most of the environments are done with that, you know, sort of plasticky pre-rendered look as well, which is very similarly incongruous. And they both came out in 96, so I guess this was just something that was happening to the 16-bit games in their dying days.
Oh, well, not even that. I mean, going to 32 and you got Final Fantasy and stuff, it was
yeah,
that was
true.
Around
look
for
how
quite
much
a while.
Detail we can squeeze onto the screen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it continued to be popular, like, obviously, like, Yoshi's Story, all kinds of stuff, but it's just weird to see these kind of halfway houses where, like, I guess they felt they couldn't change the character design so much to go, like, a full Donkey Kong Country style, but somehow it was convenient for them to do it for the environments and things like that. I thought it was kind of
Donkey Kirby would have been interesting. Pre-rendered Kirby or whatever, big hulking, plasticky.
But I mean, in terms of the game itself, I mean, it's yeah, it is gentle and sort of good fun. I mean, I guess a lot of the fun of it is almost more like playing with a toy than playing a game, because it's very sort of hands off, it's very kind of free in certain areas, and you know, a lot of it is just messing around with the abilities. But the level design doesn't tend to leverage those into a situation where they become pivotal. Their manipulation becomes pivotal to achieving things in the game. It's just kind of mess around with them and have fun. And I mean, there's, you know, considering they are kind of superfluous, There's a lot of fun to be had with just messing around with. There's all sorts of little details. They're very cute, and you can do like a dragon punch with one of them, and he can, like, he sort of, when he gets the wizard ability, he sort of sidles along in this very amusing fashion instead of running. There's just all these little touches that are very sort of funny. But I guess the biggest thing is that, you know, it is, I hesitate to use the term lightweight given the game, but that's what it is. But for 800 points, I think it's a decent fit. So I hope they extend this idea of releasing it on the Virtual Console in the West as well. Although I think my favourite part of it is probably the Great Cave Offensive part that I've played so far, because the thing about that is it does put Kirby in more confined spaces, which makes a lot more sense, because all of a sudden it's sort of floatiness can kind of work against you, and you can't just, you know, soar over everything or anything like that. It actually brings some constraints and some problems into navigating the environment with Kirby. So it's kind of like, yes, this kind of level design, even if it isn't immaculate in its execution, is generally seems to be a lot more rational to put on top of something with Kirby's abilities than the Dreamland stuff where you can kind of just sail over it.
Yeah, the problem with Great Cave Offensive, though, and it is the most popular part of that game, but the problem with it, I think, is the navigation, because it's all tied together in this kind of map, and these sections are just, they're connected by warp points, so there's no memorable, meaningful connection from one area of the world to another. It just kind of gets down to, you just kind of have to memorize which warp point goes to which area. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed the similarity between Great Cave Offensive and the Subspace Emissary and Brawl.
No,
it's
absolutely
pretty much the same thing.
It's
very
similar.
Same problems. Yeah.
It's I mean, if you're a big Smash Brothers guy and you've never played this game, it's really cool to see the heritage, because there's so much. I mean, there is so much stuff that you could link back to Smash Bros. I mean, the music that plays when you save in the Great Cave Offensive is used in the All-Star mode of Smash Bros. Melee. There's, like, all of the moves of the Kirby characters in Brawl come from his abilities, like the way he will throw characters or the way he'll do is you can see them in this game. Even the way you double tap to dash is the same. I mean, there's so much. And it's funny when you think about it that it's 96. It was only 3 years before the original Smash Bros. How close it was, you know, you think of it being a generation apart, but it's actually quite close. And you could see so much of it, of course, because it is Hal and Sakurai and all that. It's the same people. And, of course, the music. If you've enjoyed hearing Kirby music and other stuff, this is kind of nice to hear it from the source. There's loads of really cool mixes of familiar tunes. So it's fun, but I think it's better suited as a Virtual Console game, personally. And then the other thing I wanted to follow up on is I finished Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story this week. And just to kind of finish up on how well it kind of sustains things through past the halfway point, I think it does well. I mean, the one thing I thought it did well was the boss fights. They're always interesting. They're always somewhat different. Like, you know, I think one of the problems I had with going back and playing Paper Mario is how the interactive elements by the end, just you'd done them so many times, and they didn't really manage to differentiate them very well between battles. You just felt like you were doing the same thing, you know, in perpetuity. And with Mario & Luigi, I think both previous Mario & Luigi games did a better job of making it feel a bit more varied. But this one, I think, does the best job, not just because of the Bowser stuff and splitting it between two different groups of characters, but also because the boss designs themselves are just a little more inventive. They've got a lot of different kinds of cues and things like that. It's just, that's part of it's really well done, and it certainly doesn't drag on like Partners in Time did in the second half. In fact, you kind of wish it went on a little longer, which I guess is always a good sign, although yeah, I don't know. It doesn't quite feel as long as the other two, maybe. I'm not sure.
That would be okay with me.
Yeah, I mean, I was fine. In general, I was happy with the length. I definitely didn't drag. It plays really well. I was very, very pleased. I would say, overall, as a package, it probably is the superior game of the three Mario & Luigi games. But, of course, it kind of lacks the impact of the original. Even though they do a lot of good things to try and keep it fresh, can't have the same impact because it's just not as, you know, not as original as that one was.
Sure.
Although I guess they can veer towards a bit too much gimmickry, and so there's like a part where you're controlling them on a floating platform with the stylus and stuff, and it's just like, do we need this really? You know, there's a few things like that, but it's very minor. Overall, it's very well executed.
Now, Billy, have you played this yet?
No, I haven't. I was actually I was curious about it because I'm a fan of the series. The writing is what's always brought me into it because it's so fresh, and those guys at NOA really do a number on the dialogue and the characters, and just have so much fun with it and so much fun with the world and with Mario and Luigi and the whole cast, really. So
yeah.
What'd you think about the story? And
I talked about this last week. The best thing is that how they leverage Bowser, because Bowser's very funny, and he's just, you know, he's always so brash and he's full of bluster, but at the same time he's kind of incredibly bumbling. One of the most amusing parts is his legions have been overtaken by Fawful from the original game,
right,
who's now in charge of all of Bowser's minions. But there's this little renegade group that Bowser thinks is helping him, and then they betray him and push him and lock him in a safe and throw him away and stuff like that. It's just definitely would be friendly for kids, but there's enough there. There's enough sort of amusing kind of references in with the series and just, you know, little cultural stuff that makes it very, very enjoyable for older players or Nintendo veterans. So yeah, it straddles that kind of Pixar balance pretty well.
Good.
Again.
That's impressive. All right, well, James, speaking of RPGs.
Yes.
Ta-ta-ta-ta.
Is that my sign to go?
That's your cue.
Oh, okay.
Stage left.
In sort of a not quite as just grab whatever experience as we discussed last week, I purchased The Last Remnant, which is a Square Enix RPG, which they described as their attempt of creating a more international profile. It's kind of their merger of Japanese and Western RPG elements.
I remember the reviews for The Last Remnant being all over the place.
They are.
I mean, it came out, I guess, about a year ago.
Yeah, they're a little bit under a year, yeah. They're scattershot as hell. But I bought it under the assurances of someone whose opinion I trust highly.
Not John.
No, not John. I trust highly.
Yeah.
He assured me the reviews are all over the place, but in a large part, it's due to the graphical pop-ins really souring your impression of the game. And they are terrible. I have never seen a game with worse pop-in ever. So whenever you enter an area, when the scene loads, there's no textures. It's just like walls with color. And then like like anywhere between half a second to a full second later, all the texture comes in from the Unreal 3 engine. This doesn't just happen when you like enter a city or anything. This can happen in cutscenes. So there will be cutscenes where like a character is just a face with a completely untextured outfit on, and then bam, there goes all the texture. And it's not just it happens sometimes. It happens consistently every time there's a loading screen. It's like the loading screen is just like a second and a half too short.
Which for Square is so bizarre, because
it is,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I don't think it's the engine. I think it's the fact that Square just didn't really get their bearings with the engine, and maybe they were rushed. I don't know, but I mean,
yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And the weird thing is the PC version, which I believe came out the same time.
No, it came out a few months later. It was sort of the fixed edition.
Yes, it doesn't have any of these problems.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I remember Tycho from Penny Arcade talking about the PC version. He's like, oh, this is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And he really liked it, but he was like, the PC version is like definitely the way to play it.
It is so surreal. But I mean, in comparison, how much less I paid for it because I got a used copy on 360, I can deal with the pop-in.
So yeah, beyond technical problems, I mean, what's it like? How do you like it?
I'm not too far into it. I'm probably about 4 or 5 hours into it. And one thing the game is that it doesn't really explain what the hell's going on. So there's a relatively complicated battle system in which you have units that don't act independently, but rather are built into these groups referred to as unions, in which there has to be at least one, quote, union leader unit, and then at least five other, or up to five other units, or which are characters, in a formation of your choosing. And then your party is comprised of a series of unions.
So you're commanding like an army.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's like up to 75 characters. And the problem is, it's really freaking complicated to build unions. Like, I couldn't figure out for the life of me how to put other characters in the main character's union. Which for the first few hours of the game is fine, because they're giving you these pre-built unions with a bunch of third-party characters involved. So you're fine. You can use them. You think, oh, this is easy. You know, I'll give my attack command, my magic command. This is great. But then when you finally have to build one and you're on your own, you don't know what the hell you're doing or even how to get people to be in your union with you. And you go to, like, the first quest you're given and you're destroyed because you're just not strong enough to do anything by yourself. So it took me about 2.5 hours and finally a Google search to figure out how the hell to make a unit that won't be destroyed. And, like, I was convinced that the game just must be the hardest game I've ever played.
They should have built Google into The Last Remnant.
It's a typical Square Enix game. You're supposed to buy the game and the strategy guide together, so you know what the hell you're supposed to be doing.
It was amazing. Like, I'm like, did they really make a game this hard? Did they really intend for you not to be able to complete any quests for the first hours of the game? And then at which point, I think I dissolved the main character's union because I was mad at it, because I couldn't figure out how to... I had actually bought a mercenary on the street for all of my money. So I spent all my money on this guy and couldn't figure out how to put him in his own unit. Like, he had his own union by himself, and I couldn't figure out how to get him in the other one. I just got mad and dissolved them both, kind of angry.
The good news, James, is I've heard a lot that the Final Fantasy XIII battle system is pretty simple. Like, very similar to previous battle systems in that series.
In a way, I kind of like this now that I've got it under control. But it took so long to get... I mean, this could have all been solved with a tutorial. A 5-minute tutorial. This would have been solved.
And yet people complain about tutorials all the time.
Well, I complain about this game's tutorials because there's a 30-minute tutorial that doesn't tell you how to do a damn thing. In the game, you're constantly getting these split-second tutorials during battle. Like, a text box pops up in the middle of a battle after something happens to tell you what the hell just happened. Now, it could have happened... told you before it happened so you could have prepared for it, but instead it tells you after, when it's already struck you and you're screwed. But what I do like about the battle system is that you get to build these big units and then sort of command them around. So I think the biggest fight I've had so far was I had 3 unions on the battlefield and the enemy had like 7. So it really did feel just like complete chaos, which is kind of cool, even though it's all turn-based. When you can see the graphics, they look nice. But since you can't for extended periods of time, it's not quite there. And I'm still not quite sure what to make of this story. It's got a lot of long cutscenes. Long Square Enix-style cutscenes that aren't particularly insightful.
James, do you have any reviews coming up for the site?
I would like to.
Well, I heard that nostalgia is up for grabs.
Is it?
DS RPG from Shane Bettenhausen, Man God, Inc.
Yes. Yeah, the only thing I have definitively claimed is the Crystal Bears.
Yeah, Luke was telling me that earlier today about nostalgia, and I was like, shit, if I still wrote reviews, I would totally get that.
Yeah, I actually played that at E3.
I'm retired from reviews. Maybe you'll be talking about that next week.
Airship games.
Well, I'll finish up new business here. I've got a few things I want to mention. First off, maybe I'll just briefly say about Beatles Rock Band, the number one selling music game of September 2009. It just got the first round of big DLC, which was the Abbey Road album. And the strange thing about this is that almost half of that album was already on the disc. So it seems kind of a soft rollout for the big Beatles album download content, you know? And it's still, for the remainder that you get, it's still $16, so it ain't cheap.
Which is bullshit.
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like it's ridiculously overpriced, but I think you have to be aware that you are basically getting the dregs of that album. And that's not to say that these songs are bad, because Abbey Road is clearly one of the best albums ever, and almost every song on there I love. But if these songs were that great to play in Rock Band, they would have put them on the disc like they did with the other ones.
No, they wouldn't, because there are people like you.
No, because they can charge you for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, look.
$16. They are raping people.
I'm okay with paying for Polythene Pam and Golden Slumbers, okay? But look, the best songs on that album for a band to play
are already
the most
in the
fun
game.
Songs are, you know, yeah, Come Together and The End. The End is probably the best song in the whole game in terms of, you know, being a really fun rock song for everybody to play together. And that's already in there. So you're getting kind of the B-sides. And that's basically what you're paying for with Abbey Road. I think it's going to be very different. When we get Sgt. Pepper next month in November, and there's very little of Sgt. Pepper already on the disc. So that's going to be a very different experience. It's going to cost more. It'll probably be $20 at least. But you're getting more songs with it. So I think Sgt. Pepper will be more justified in terms of, you know, a full album release, something that you'll actually feel cool paying for and getting. You'll feel like you get a lot of new songs, whereas Abbey Road, it feels like you only get a few. But I will say, I mean, the main justification for releasing Abbey Road and for purchasing it for me was that you get to play the whole 16-minute medley from the second half. And that's the first thing I did after I downloaded it. And it is awesome. I'd love to do it with, you know, a whole 4-person band. I played it by myself so far.
Now, for Abbey Road, do they do like a big, like, a, you know, when you're playing the different sections of Beatles Rock Band, do they have like a whole themed thing to dealing with Abbey Road? Or is it
like
just
the dreamscape?
Yeah. Is it just the songs and that's it?
They're still specific to the songs. But the downloaded songs do have their own new dreamscapes. And they've said that they kind of cobbled them together from things that you may have seen in other songs, things that may have been on the disc, but they never used them in any of the other songs. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, when you play Carry That Weight, you're not going to see, like, anvils all over the place or scales or anything like that. But I will say that the songs that I downloaded for it, the dreamscapes, as far as I saw, they did seem to fit the songs very well, and they weren't just completely reused from other stuff. So I don't know how long they can keep that up. At some point, the downloads may have to get bigger. They may have to start including other stuff, or they may just have to wholesale reuse it from other songs. I don't know. Anyway, in terms of new stuff this week, I did download Lost Winds 2. I think it's called Winter of the Melodias. And it's really, really good. I mean, it's clearly one of the best games on WiiWare. Lost Winds, the first one, I've talked about it before. I played it at Windy Man's house a couple years ago at E3. I never bought it, but I played through most of it at his place. And I liked it. I didn't like it enough that I wanted to go home and buy it for myself. For one thing, I had already played through most of it for free at his house. But, you know, I wasn't crazy about it, but I thought it was really well done. And with the sequel, it was a pretty easy decision to go ahead and pick it up, especially reading that it improved on the first one and everything, and it was kind of tighter and better put together. And I was actually kind of blown away by it from the very beginning. It starts out with this extremely impressive sequence where this rock monster, it must be a character from the first game that I wasn't familiar with, but this rock monster helps you get through the environment by lifting you up on his hand, and then later he sort of breaks through some stuff and he's all in the background, but you're kind of cooperating with him to get across these giant gaps and stuff like that. And the rock monster is absolutely amazingly animated. I mean, it looks incredible. And overall, I would say, I mean, most of the game is not quite that impressive in terms of, it doesn't stand out quite as much, but the game does look really, really, really good all the way through. It's very impressive aesthetically. The music is very nice. The music actually kind of reminds me of Okami in that it seems to be sort of Japanese style instruments. It tends to be very slow. There's a lot of space in it. So it feels kind of ambient, but it's not just random sounds or anything. It is musical instruments, but they're playing very slowly in an ambient kind of way. But the puzzles do get pretty interesting later on. And for the most part, I've really enjoyed them, except there's one area when you spend the first part of the game trying to get into this city of the Melodias. And when you finally do have all the upgrades and abilities and everything that you need to get in there, you go in there, and it presents you with a puzzle that is leveraged on knowledge that you would have gained in the first game.
Really? I'm quite surprised by that.
I was too. I spent quite a bit of time around there just frustrated, really frustrated, trying to figure out what I was supposed to do. I was pretty sure this is where I was supposed to be. And I just couldn't get through this wall. And finally, I broke down and went to GameFAQs and read up on it. And it turns out you have to use a technique that is not taught to you in the sequel. It's something that you would have had to carry over from the first game. It involves raising a rock up into the air and then creating a vortex around it to suspend it in the air. And when you do that, it kind of becomes strong. And then you can toss it against a wall to break the wall. And I had tossed the rock against the wall a dozen times trying to get it go through, but I hadn't made the little vortex around it to suspend it in the air, which imbues it with magical strength that allows it to break through things. And the game never tells you this. So if you're like me and you kind of skipped over the first one or didn't play all of it, you're going to get really frustrated when you get to that part.
I am kind of surprised about it also from the point of view that, you know, in some ways this is coming a little later than we might have thought. You know, where you might have thought it would have been a bit closer to the first one, and something like that, even for people who did play it, I mean...
Right, you could have easily forgotten about that.
You may have played it at the launch of WiiWare and long forgotten about it. Since so it seems like a kind of episodic content kind of thing that you would do, and those are the sorts of things that come out, you know, month on month, not nearly 16 months later or whatever it's been, 18 months.
Yeah, it's been a year and a half. And I think it's just a failing. I think it's just a very poor design decision. And it's surprising because the game overall seems to be very, very meticulously designed. It is extremely well made.
How do you think it makes
game.
Use of the sort of season switching stuff in the puzzles? Is that good? Is it well integrated?
It's well done. You don't switch seasons quite as much as you might expect, because you can only do it at these statues, so you can only do it at predetermined points, and you have to go to the statue to switch seasons. And I think knowing that it's limited like that, the puzzles tend to be designed so you don't have to switch back and forth a lot to solve them. So far I think it's been handled well, but it's not exactly a really freeform ability that you gain and then you can use whenever you want to. It doesn't feel like that at all. It's more like, you know, this is built into the levels. You will use it when we say that you should use it. It's one of those kinds of abilities. There are other abilities that you can kind of use wherever, and those I think are more interesting. But Lost Winds 2 is really, really good. If you like the first one, you're definitely going to like this. And if you skipped out on the first one like I did, I think you should still pick this up. It's very impressive. Very good stuff. The other thing I played quite a bit of this week is Little King's Story. And of course, you know, James talked about this a lot when it first came out. Greg had it when it was out in Europe for a while. I actually picked it up at least a month ago when it dropped to $30 in America.
Nice.
Because I knew I wanted to play it. It's just at the time, I had all these other things that I was playing. And for some reason, it got to a point where, you know, when you have kind of a game of shame that you know you should play and that you kind of want to play, but it's been on your shelf. Yeah, you already own it, but it's been on your shelf for so long that you start to kind of dread it. Like, there's this weird inertia. I don't know. At some point, I lose sight of what the game is really like or what I expect it to be like. I'm no longer thinking about the gameplay, about the enjoyment I'm going to have from it. I'm thinking about, man, I don't want to have to start a brand new game. I don't want to have to put it in there. I don't want to have to deal with all that. I've got these other things, and it's always going to be there waiting for me. So it gets into like a really nasty kind of cycle where there were a couple times where I could have put this in earlier and I didn't because of just poor psychology, basically.
All I can ever say is that sometimes when I have a new game, not that it sat for a while, I don't start it because I feel like the time commitment to starting a game is massive.
Yeah. It can be. I mean, there's an uncertainty. You know, you don't know.
Yeah, that initial sitting can go on for a long time.
Yeah.
So you best to set aside a decent amount of time unless you know it's something that's going to be a lot more interruptible.
Right.
It depends on the game. You know, when you have like a Final Fantasy 12 sitting in front of your face, you're like, you know, that's 40.
God, do I have 3 days? Can I start this?
Yeah, that's like a crap load of time sitting in front of you. What did you think of Little King's Story? I've been following that game since it was announced.
Oh, Billy, You will love it.
You know, I've heard really, really good things, and I've heard it's a total sleeper, and that people should pick it up.
It's really fantastic.
I cried at the end. It was a magical moment.
So, you know, everybody says Little King Story is a lot like Pikmin, and there's no denying that. It's definitely a lot like Pikmin. But I think there are two things that surprised me about it when I finally got the gumption to put it in and start playing it. Number one, it is very beautiful. And not only is it very beautiful, but it has this great joyful aura around it that makes me really happy when I'm playing it. Like, I get kind of excited and giddy when I start getting into it.
That'll change, don't worry.
Maybe eventually it'll get frustrating, but I think early on it's like, wow, this game, it's not only just really cute in the Harvest Moon sense, but it's actually really compelling and really, I don't know if attractive is the right word, but I mean, it's just very, very appealing in a way that kind of took me by surprise, I think. The other part of it is, it's as much an RPG, I think, as a strategy game, which you could never say about Pikmin. You know, Pikmin was very much go from this item to the next, and then we'll move on. And what I really like about Little King Story is that you're always starting from the same place. And as you go through and achieve different things in the course of the game, it sort of expands your kingdom. It gives you new things that you can now build, new jobs that you can give to the citizens, some new abilities, maybe some new little sort of side objectives that you can work on. I mean, it feels very much like an RPG in that you're constantly pushing against the borders of what you're capable of and where you can go and what there is for you to do. And I wasn't expecting that at all, and I think that's one of the main things that really sets us apart from Pikmin. Pikmin feels a little more like an action game, a little more straightforward.
Yeah, definitely. It's very, very different in that sense.
And you know, I love that stuff. I mean, I'm a big RPG fan. I haven't really played many RPGs lately. And Little King Story, I wasn't expecting that at all out of it. And it just immediately grabbed me, and it just makes me want to play more and more and more of it. It's quite addicting. So, yeah, I think it's great. And I have to say, I love the music. I mean, I know, James, you had talked about it all being classical music and everything. And I remember at one point I thought, oh, that sounds great. But then it had sort of faded in the background of what I was expecting from the game. And I started up, and the music just instantly hooked me.
I mean, it's good music. It's just kind of like, well,
Actually, it's stuff that you've heard before. And I think that's actually kind of a benefit. Lends the game a nice air of familiarity that it wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, and some of the arrangements are very different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is something you can appreciate from the Smash Brothers soundtrack or whatever. You know, when you hear things that you're very familiar with deconstructed or whatever and put into a very different kind of context, it's just amusing in a way. You know, there's just something almost like a musical joke about it that just kind of clicks in your head that I like.
I think there's definitely a musical joke to boiling down. I can't place a lot of these because I'm not that much of an I'm not that much of an archivist about classical. I mean, I know what I know, but I don't know a lot of the details about a lot of it. But just as an example, I mean, they might cut down one of Mozart's symphonies into a 5-second clip that plays while you're sleeping. Like, just even the little jingles that you would associate, you know, like in a Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest game, they have little 10-second musical interludes for all these different things when you're saving, when you're in the shop, when you're talking to the king or whatever. And all of those in Little King Story are deconstructed from classical music, and it's really funny, actually, to realize that all of this was, you know, what most of us now would consider very grand, old-fashioned, respectable, classic music, and they're kind of just snipping out 5 seconds of it for this video game for a very mechanical RPG thing. I don't know, it kind of cracks me up. I think there's something very absurd about it.
No, that's where it really works for me.
But Billy, you should really, really, really check out Little King Story. You're going to love it.
Cool.
Knowing that you're a big fan of Pikmin, you're going to like it a lot. When we have guests on, we always try to convince them they need to pick up their Wii again and put something interesting into it. So, all right, we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll have a feature discussion on difficulty in gaming. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. There's plenty going on at NWR as we wind down the month of October.
In reviews this week, Lucas Belicki gives us his take on Wii Fit Plus, which he says is ultimately a better product than the original Wii Fit, And in features, we have the next installment in our series of roundtable discussions, this one on the future of gaming control, and be sure to provide us with your opinion in our forums.
Michael Cole also hosts our weekly radio trivia podcast along with RFN veteran James Jones. Be sure to give our Third Pillar podcast a listen.
As always, check out Nintendo World Report for Nintendo coverage 365 days a year, including Christmas. I want my scalps. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for your patented, I should say patented, Greg Lay feature discussion. This one's going to be about dear difficulty God. In games. And
well, thanks for the enthusiasm, James, really.
That was towards Johnny, not towards you. Johnny's busy quoting the second funniest World War II movie of the year.
Uh-huh. What was the first?
Oh, Valkyrie.
Valkyrie was last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is Valkyrie awful? Because I put
it... No, it's really good.
Okay.
It is not even as introspective as Inglourious Basterds, okay? But
it is funny, though, in ways it never intends to be.
I don't entirely disagree with that, but I do think Valkyrie is a really fun action thriller. If you don't take it too seriously, you're going to enjoy it a lot. I was surprised, actually, at how much I enjoyed it.
Okay.
I was kind of expecting bad things. And I thought it was actually really, really fun.
I'm ripping through a lot of Blu-rays on my Netflix queue, and so far I'm on a streak of really crappy movies that I've watched.
Good. Oh,
and so I just watched Wolverine today. Awful.
Oh, God.
Seriously, I would have rather punched myself in the groin.
Yeah.
With Wolverine's claws.
Seriously, that movie blew ass. And then, well, actually, and I also watched Crank 2, which... Crank.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh my God.
The character's
name is Chev Chelios. The first
Crank is awesome. It's so bad. But, like, Crank 2 is actually pretty... It's hilarious. If you don't take... I mean, because you can't take it serious. The dude, exactly.
It's not meant to be taken serious.
Yeah, isn't there an implication at the end of the first one that it was a video game?
It's so awful. Like, this guy punts this guy's head into a pool at the end of the movie, and I'm just like, I stood up and clapped. I'm like, this movie sucks. Put it on your Netflix queue. But anyway.
Okay, so for the difficulty in gaming feature, Greg's going to take charge here.
Completely switching gears now.
Yes, uh-huh. we've been kicking this idea around for a while, but you know, we've always been doing other stuff with retroactive things. It's got to get topical again now because you've got new Super Mario Bros. Wii coming out, and the Super Guide or Demo Play, whatever you want to call it, feature is going to be in that, and that's kind of generated a certain amount of discussion. But we're not just going to focus on that, really. The first part of the discussion I wanted to have was just about how important difficulty and challenge is in gaming generally. I mean, is it still important because of all the changes that have happened in the kind of content you get in games nowadays? So I'm going to kick it off. I'm going to start with Johnny. I mean, for you, how important is it for a game to tax you?
It depends. There are certain games that I think are very, very, very easy that I also think are absolutely worth playing through. You know, I talked about Flower a couple weeks ago. It never at any point is that a difficult game. You can't die. I mean, you basically can't fail in Flower.
Win button.
Which is not to say there's no skill, but the skill tends to be fairly optional. It's a bit like Kirby in that respect, maybe, but I think it's totally worth playing through. So I don't think challenge or difficulty is a requisite for games, but I think it can be used in very constructive ways to make a game better if used properly. And unfortunately, I think challenge is probably, and it's tied in with a lot of things like, you know, artificial intelligence, level design, depending on the kind of game it is. But I think challenge is probably one of the most difficult elements of a game to finesse properly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, that certainly Nintendo is among the companies that is best at doing just that. They're very good about thinking about, you know, and I do think in the past few years, a lot of Nintendo's games have been too easy. Certainly not all. I mean, you look at stuff like F-Zero GX, that game's brutal.
Yeah, that game is extremely difficult. Yeah.
And I know Nintendo didn't make it in-house, but they supervised it.
You know, they approved all that. So, I mean, you'd think that'd be something that I'd have plenty of feedback on, is the difficulty level, yeah.
Yeah, but F-Zero X was hard as balls, too, so, I mean...
Oh,
yeah.
It wasn't as hard, though. I don't think. They took it up a significant notch for GX.
They took it up many notches. Yeah. They said, let's make this game the hardest game ever released on a Nintendo system. Not make it
it's
a little bit harder.
I mean, it's probably not NES quite.
No, I'm not counting those games.
Yeah, the broken
ones.
They
were hard because they didn't understand how to be hard and how to be fair.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I guess the point is, for me, thinking back to playing in the... I mean, you know, you think of difficulty, you can't help but think about the 8-bit games. I mean, for me, when you had a game in the 8-bit era, obviously it'd have to be a good game to keep you playing. But, you know... If it was very difficult and then you overcame it, I mean, that was a real, especially when you're a kid, you are with this sort of thing, it's a real sense of pride and accomplishment. And obviously, you lose that somewhat because you grow up and it's not as important to you anymore. But also, in terms of the changes that have gone on in games, I mean, do you still get that from any modern games, would you say?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, Mirror's Edge was a big one. But actually, in that game in particular, a lot of times I felt like I should have succeeded at this 20 attempts ago. And it's just kind of arbitrary that I had to keep doing it over and over until it finally worked. So that's actually a very poor example, I think, of a game being difficult.
The game we discussed earlier, Little King's Story. There are some boss battles in that game that are of questionable difficulty. And I don't mean to say it is a question of are they difficult. I mean, it is a question of were the designers sadists.
I think games have really started to puss out, quite honestly. I mean, not only do I think, like, for example, I just finished Uncharted. There's a lot of pop-ups that come up. Like, if you're in a spot for too long, it'll be like, oh, press up, or I think it was press up on the D-pad or whatever, to have Nathan look at what you're supposed to do next. Or it gives you automatic hints, and it's like, why are you doing this?
Go here.
I'm quite surprised to hear that from something that's trying to be very cinematic. It seems like the kind of thing would sort of take you out of the experience a little bit.
Well, press
I know why developers are doing this, and it's because they want people to actually finish their games. Like, the average person doesn't actually finish games. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't play games all the way to completion, which I think is sad, but I think games really have been dumbed down to the point where they are too easy. Especially, I mean, you guys are joking about going back to the NES era, but that's the way it used to be. I mean, you know, I found it funny in Donkey Kong Country when they joked about the fact that, you know, back when I was a kid, there were only 3 lives and that was it, you know, and that is so true. And like, you know, nowadays you have, not only do you have like this hint system thing that Uncharted brought in, which I was kind of disappointed that they did, but you also have scalable difficulty in other games where if you do go through and you play a certain level over and over and over and over and you can't get past something, the game automatically makes itself easier so you can get through it.
Yeah, it's a dynamic. Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk plenty about some of the ways that the developers these days try and sort of tailor it to, because of course gaming is so big now. It's not just this little cadre of young savants and hardcore arcade people.
Yeah, before we move on to anything else, I do want to say that I kind of disagree with Billy here, that I think the good old days of 8-bit or whatever really weren't as good as we think. I mean, back then we adapted to that, and maybe what we miss is not the difficulty, but the feeling of getting better at a game until the point when you can actually get farther. And I think the best modern games, the games that deal with difficulty the best in the modern age, are those that aren't necessarily difficult, and they don't even require like a lot of natural skill to beat or anything like that, but they do have sort of built-in systems. They have a language that you have to learn.
Right.
And the learning of that is fun. In fact, that's one of the main reasons to play the game, is that it is enjoyable to learn how these systems work, to get better at it, to develop the motor skills or whatever. And I think it's okay if a game babysits you a little bit as you learn to do these things, as long as it then turns you loose a bit and has you experiment and you actually use those things in a creative way. And those are my favorite kinds of games. And I mean, I think of stuff like this is not exactly modern, but, you know, Super Metroid is a game that does an extremely good job of that. It is not really an especially difficult game at any point.
Nah, definitely not.
But by the end of it, you're doing things, not just with upgrades, but you're actually performing mechanical feats that you couldn't have done in the beginning because you didn't know how. And the game never even really tells you how to do these things. It sort of introduces you very subtly with, and it ramps up in difficulty, but it presents you with all these situations in which you kind of have to try a few things out, see what works. And to me, that is much, much more valuable than banging your head against a wall 20 times until you finally break through, which is what a lot of old 8-bit games were based around. And a lot of those came from arcade games, which are artificially difficult.
So this is the thing, we can look at some of the reasons why things have changed. And like you said, obviously, at first you've got the arcade model, which is take your money. Simple as that, really. There's no other way of summing it up.
All right, let's make this as hard as we can, because we need some quarters.
Then, of course, you get to the 8-bit, and even the home games, right, whether they're conversions or whether they're original titles, like, say, Castlevania, they're still very much informed by that. And, of course, you know, even though, as Billy Connett said, even now, you might not think that developers and publishers would be so concerned about people playing through to the end if they've already got your money, but apparently they are.
Well, they're building franchises.
Yeah,
so that's
exactly.
Why.
And word of mouth. In the past, I think there would have been a concern that, you know, if a game was quite easy, people would, you know, because they didn't have the horsepower in the consoles or the development budgets to make these huge epic productions, if they were easy, you would burn through them in a very short period of time. And so, you know, even though there wasn't the imperative to take your quarters anymore, still those games were made in a sort of very ruthlessly sort of functional way to just say, just make it take longer, essentially.
Okay, so it's really easy to say, well, games have changed so much, it's hard to compare difficulty back then to the way it is now. But I think what we have coming out with New Super Mario Bros. Wii is a very, very good case study here. And my question for all of you is, go back to the very first Super Mario Brothers. You could earn extra lives, but they were very difficult to find. It was hard to get 100 coins in that game, period.
Yeah,
and the one-up mushrooms were hidden, usually. They're very hard to find. You weren't likely to know how to get them. And the continue function was secret. So a lot of people played through that game for a long time before realizing you could hold down select and press start at the title screen to continue. So let's set the continue function aside for now and say basically you get thrown into that game with 3 lives, not 5, 3 lives, and you may or may not get any extra lives, and that's what you have to play through the entire game with. My question to all of you is, if New Super Mario Bros. Wii did that,
I would hate.
Would you be okay with that?
No. I'd probably be all right with it, but really, it's dependent.
You
it's
don't
dependent
count.
On.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But it's dependent on the level design. I mean, ultimately, just saying 3 lives in isolation means nothing unless we know how, you know, legitimately often are you likely to lose those lives based on the challenge contained in the actual levels, the level design, the enemy design, the bosses, all these things. It's a total package thing, which is why it can be very difficult to strike a balance, because, you know, if you change one thing, it upsets everything else, and sort of, you know, tweaking every aspect to get it exactly where you want is a very challenging process, which is why you just don't see it done perhaps quite perfectly very often.
Well, you don't hear about it as much, but I think a good developer balances an action game just as much as you would have to balance a 2D fighting game like Street Fighter, just as much as you have to balance an MMO like WoW, just as much as you have to balance a strategy game like Total Annihilation, Supreme Commander, StarCraft II. These are genres where you hear a lot about. The developer spends a lot of time beta testing and balancing, and they go back and patch it later, you know, if things are out of whack. And I think even with something as seemingly simple as a new Mario game for Wii, I think you have to balance it just as much for all the reasons that you're saying. It's very delicate.
Yeah, but Nintendo would never do that. I know that's you're just theoretically saying, oh, what if they would? Would I like it? I mean, personally for me,
well,
I would laugh my ass off.
They did do that back in the mid-80s. That's what I'm saying.
Right, but the audience, well, first off, I mean, things so much has changed in the 25-odd years.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, you know, 30 years, you know, but that being said, the audience that this game is for is not only, I mean, it's barely for people like us, the hardcore Nintendo fans, This is to get people to actually buy a Mario game that played it 30 years ago that isn't as dexterous as they were when they were 8, you know?
Or more contemporary that played the DS game, which is very forgiving.
Right, and I mean, or on top of it, I mean, people like me and you guys who don't have the amount of time to be able to devote to a game like, you know, Super Mario World or Super Mario Brothers, where you could honestly just piss away an entire day playing a game during a summer, you know, when you had no other responsibilities. I mean, you know, now it's like, I guarantee there's going to be at least two to three one-ups in the first level of the game.
Oh, right. Definitely, yeah.
Well, it's a party game, effectively. And that's why I would have an issue with the three live system, because it's not just a matter of competing with the game itself, but you have to compete with the other players. I mean, there's something inherently competitive about it, even though you're all trying to achieve the same objectives.
For nostalgia purposes, though, I think having a single-player mode in the game where it was, like, called old school or back to basics, and having it start out with three guys and lessening the amount of one-ups throughout the game and making you really work for it, I think would be awesome if the Wii actually had achievements in things like that.
I was gonna say, would you play that without an achievement for it?
No, but man, if seriously, for the people like us who are super hardcore Mario fans, like, hell yeah, if the Wii had achievements, you would wear that shit with the badge of honor. You know, I mean, you'd be like, yo, I'm old school and I totally kicked this game's ass. And that's where the difficulty and things that, you know, why you guys are talking about this, why that would be really interesting and intriguing. But Nintendo's so hell-bent on being family-friendly and getting grandma to play Mario with their grandkids that they'll never do it. They'll puss out, which is kind of disappointing.
So you bring up an interesting conundrum here that I want to tease it out and just get really specific just to make sure I'm clear on this. What you're saying, Billy, is that the reason games are easier now is not, I mean, a lot of people, they talk about, you know, this game's for kids, or even your kid could play it or whatever, and a lot of people sort of, I think, erroneously associate easy games with kids games. But what you're saying is that the shift in difficulty over the past couple of decades, where games are progressively getting easier and easier, is more because they're actually targeting older players now. Not only lapsed gamers or whatever, but also like grandmas and people like that.
Yeah, the demographics have changed, you know, in various ways. Yeah, I mean, I think that is a factor.
I think on the Nintendo side, yes, especially with the Wii, I don't think as much on the... I don't really think that was the case with the GameCube, you know, because there were more hardcore games on...
Hardcorer,
I'm a winner today. But I think there were more hardcore games on the GameCube, but look at the demographics who the Wii is targeting. It's targeting families. Like, that's the bottom line. And I don't think Bungie gives two shits whether or not their game is family-friendly. It's a shooter. I mean, that's what it's for.
There are non-demographic reasons for why you've seen difficulty, you know, sort of fade into the background, or maybe, you know, the developers certainly on default settings, things like that, are going to play it safer.
Right.
Because, but, I mean, as we said, there isn't the imperative to make it difficult anymore, as it was in the past.
Yeah, but you've got multiple difficulty levels for Halo 3 ODST.
You've got more. I mean, most games will have multiple difficulty levels in some way. We're going to kind of get to that briefly, but what I wanted to say was that, you know, these days when you think about something like an Uncharted or various other games like that, you know, the storytelling's a big part of it, and you're trying to immerse people into an experience and all that kind of thing. And it just seems to me that, you know, now you might have 15 hours of content for something like that. God knows how many hours of content for an RPG. I mean, do developers want to slow that down for difficulty? I mean, do they want to be, you know, if they're so concentrated on telling a story, do they really want players to have to replay certain sections of the game over and over again, thus interrupting the flow of the storytelling just because it's difficult?
I think for certain games where they don't have that much content and they want a choke point, so it does lengthen experience. But, I mean, like you were talking about Uncharted. Look at how Sony's marketing. If you've seen the recent commercials for the PlayStation 3 and Uncharted 2, where the guy's like, "Yeah,
it's like a movie.
It's like a movie," and my girlfriend likes, you know, watching it.
And it's like, how much would she enjoy watching you swear at it as you do this thing for the 15th time in a row,
over and over?
It is something that now, you know, certain experiences they just don't really lend themselves to it very much. You know, I just don't think the challenge part is a really sort of central part of the experience. What Johnny was saying about something of flower, you're getting more into the realm of a game being an interactive experience rather than, you know, a sort of a feat of dexterity.
Well, you know, it's funny because the game that just popped up into my head, although it's relatively unrelated, is Steel Battalion. Which was so hardcore that not
relatively
only,
unrelated to flower. Yes.
Was so hardcore that not only did it require you play with the ridiculous controller, but when you died a time, it deleted your game save.
Yeah, you were done.
Jesus.
Yeah, if you didn't eject, if you didn't hit the eject button, I have Steel Battalion. If you did not eject and you died, your whole game is dead. It's over.
Yes,
death is final.
Capcom really likes messing with save features, don't they? Resident Evil, Dead Rising, Steel Battalion, they're always doing something messed up with your save files.
I mean, that is the most extreme example of this that I can think of.
I thought it was ballsy, especially since you had to pay like $200 just for the game and the controller.
Well, they know you're not just going to rage quit, right? Like, with that kind of investment, they know you're going to go back and play it more.
You have to justify it, yeah.
I paid $250 for this game.
Dude, that game was awesome.
I think if I remember correctly, Roger Ebert was sort of giving his critique of gaming not being an art form. One of the reasons he gave was that you had to beat them. You know, the experience, other forms of art to best them in combat or whatever. You know,
it's not true.
They're not things to be overcome.
He's obviously never read Faulkner.
Well, yeah, I mean, the other forms of art can be challenging in their own way. I don't think there'd be any argument
there. You don't actually challenge them. The resistance is one way.
As we get sort of more into, you know, with the kinds of visual and aural experiences you can have in games now that are more artistically leaning, you see they are ejecting that element more and more. You know, something like Flower is a pretty good example.
I want to know if Roger Ebert thinks that Crank 2 is an artistic art form.
They took artistic liberties.
Well, I mean, we should not get into the Ebert thing.
He was
not associating quality with art.
No,
those are
no,
distinct no. principles.
It could
for
be
him.
It could be art and be irredeemably bad. Yes,
right.
Certainly,
right.
I think the main thing that you kind of want to see is like, do I want, you know, something like an Uncharted to be as difficult as Ghosts and Goblins? No, but do you still want games to exist that are difficult like those old games alongside the new experiences that are more focused on storytelling or emotion? Yes, you do. That would be my position.
And I think you already do. I mean, Ninja Gaiden is a perfect example. When that game originally came out, that game was super hard, and like I sucked ass at that game, and I was really disappointed. And then when they re-released it for like the 18th time, they finally came out with the Ninja Dog difficulty mode, where if you failed a certain section over and over and over again, they gave you an easier mode to play where you could actually get through the game. And I actually think that's cool, but I also think you had to wear a pink headband or something like that.
Yeah, Explosion Man.
Yeah, Explosion Man does
and...
the same thing, where it kind of makes you wear a tutu. It embarrasses you.
I don't think ridiculing the player is really ever a good idea beyond the obvious, the one-time humor of it. I do think that offering the player a suggestion or an easier route is fine. In fact, I think that's probably better than dynamically making the game easier in the background.
Agreed.
Because the problem is, people like me, I'm the kind of person who always wants to game the system. I always want to know how things are working in the background. And if I know that the game has the potential to readjust itself based on how well I'm doing, it will drive me crazy wondering, man, did I just not do what... This part seems easy. Did I just really suck at the previous level? Or vice versa. It's like taking the GRE. I don't know if you guys have any experience with this. But the GRE is an adaptable test, and it adapts as you go through based on how well you're doing. And it absolutely drives me nuts because I'm more concerned about what the test is doing for itself based on what I'm doing than I am at actually doing well on it. And I don't want that to creep into video games.
Well,
you know?
I mean, what if
I think they should be transparent about it.
I disagree, but that's partially because artificial intelligence is kind of the things I like to research. I feel like if a game gets harder when you do well and gets easier when you don't, I think that would give you an experience that's more tailored to what you like to do.
It will. Maybe it's just a personal.
Well, that's an
that
interesting part, though, because I mean, I guess the difference between those two approaches is choice, giving the player the choice over what
right.
he would do. And I mean, that to me is a kind of really interesting conundrum. Is, you know, sometimes if you take choice away from people, you can maybe encourage them to things that they don't necessarily think they want to do, but maybe it ends up being fun, or it ends up being something that they overcome and it feels very rewarding. There's a real sense of accomplishment there. And then, you know, but if you give people a choice, do they just take the path of least resistance and end up having a less rewarding experience? I mean, for you personally, James, like, how much do you like being given choices in games?
Based on the games I play, I enjoy making my own decisions, but like, the more high-minded decision I can make, the more, you know, the more of a open canvas I have to work with, the better. So if it's a game like a hardcore strategy game, like a Total War game, the entire game is an infinite choice.
Mm, yeah, sure. But in terms of, like, say, for instance, you know, do you like it for a game to basically say, right, this is the bar, this is it, right? And it's non-negotiable, essentially. You're going to test yourself against it, and you're either going to meet it or not. Or do you like it to you know, maybe say for you to say, well, you know, if I'm struggling with this, I'd like to have the option of saying, no, I wanna go the low road, essentially.
I would, if it comes down to the inability to complete the game, obviously I want to be able to complete the game. If that means I have to take some sort of low road, then so be it.
Because, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy for giving the people more choice, especially when it's like you paid for this content.
Exactly, I paid for the whole
game. I've got a right to see it. Independent of my ability to play the game.
Take that, F0GX. I paid for the right to see the rest of these missions.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy with that point of view. But I suppose the danger in it that I see is that if the choices or the options are presented in a certain way, that it might not give you enough of a... You might be a bit too quick, you know what I mean? It might be a bit too much of a path of least resistance. I mean, do you see that? Or do you think, well, people... You know, they know what they like. They'll do whatever's best for them, and that's it.
I think if you paid for the game, you should be able to experience it however you want to experience. If you want the game to basically be a movie where you press buttons occasionally, if the game supports that, I don't see why it's negative for them to allow you to do that. If you want the game to be painfully, punishingly hard, well, all right, go for it. I mean, whatever makes you happy.
Yeah, I mean,
ideally, you buy video games to be entertained and have fun. Why the hell a developer defines what the difficulty level that is fun, it doesn't necessarily seem like it should be the law.
See, I like the way God of War handled it, and I don't know if you guys played any of the games in the series, but if you got stuck in a certain area, it would say, hey, do you want to dumb down the difficulty? Yes or no? And right there, you can make the choice. Do I want to puss out? Do I want to make this a little easier so I can get through this part? And then after that, you can ramp it back up. You can, you know, switch the difficulty on the fly. Like, I think that's really smart. The dynamic stuff really kind of irritates me. I think I agree with you guys. I think you should have the choice. I think...
Make it explicit and say, you know, do you want to do it and all that. And what about the idea of, you know, this idea of you're building in sort of consequences for the choice in terms of, like, I don't know, maybe you don't get an achievement if you take the low road, or you do have to wear the pink whatever, you know, is that ultimately that kind of stuff is kind of trivial, but they're trying to encourage you a certain way. So, oh, we'll give you the choice, but actually we're kind of making you think you shouldn't be choosing this.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't mind
the achievements, because it literally, if you beat a game on the brutal, nasty, ugly, hard mode, then yeah, it literally is an achievement. You have achieved something.
It's a case of positive reinforcement versus negative.
Right.
I'm okay with achievements or unlockable power-ups or whatever being offered as an incentive to play the game at a higher difficulty level if the game is appreciably a different experience at a higher difficulty level. And I think in a lot of games, the way that these really difficult levels are introduced is just very cynical to me. It's like all the enemies will have more energy, you'll have less, you'll do less damage, go. And to me, that usually does not result in a very different gameplay experience. It's not going to make me take on different tactics. It's not going to make me enjoy the, you know, some previously unseen aspect of the game. Now, there are games where playing it on hard versus normal is a completely different experience because they change a lot of things. It's a really kind of overall total makeover of how the game plays, and that is intriguing to me. It doesn't happen very often, but I'm all for that. I mean, I'm very interested in
this is bringing some interesting points there. So when you're talking about selectable difficulty settings, choices, I mean, the first thing I think is you've got a bit of an issue of framing effects. You know, when you give people some of these choices, for instance, plenty of developers have said, a particular recent example was when they were talking about Contra 4 on Retronauts. They were saying, well, we made the easy mode friendly to people relatively, you know, but the problem,
not that friendly.
I said relatively. But yeah. The problem that they found was that people were quite unwilling to play on easy because it was called easy. So even though you might say, well, surely people are going to, if they find the one level too hard, they'll go to the other one. That in fact, just by the nomenclature, they were put off.
What if they just called it Course A, and the normal was Course B, and hard was Course C?
I think you see some evidence for that. If you look at the Metroid Prime series, how they with the first two, it was easy, normal, and hard. And then all of a sudden, when you got to the Wii, it was, was it a veteran?
Yeah, normal, veteran, and...
And hyper mode was hard and all. So, it was very much like hyper mode, which was not available from the start in Metroid Prime 3, for instance. It was very obvious, it's like, don't play this unless you're insane. Basically, it's kind of rather than just hard, it's very...
Yeah, but unfortunately, the Metroid Prime series, I think, is a series where it's not really that much more interesting to play it at a higher difficulty.
No, I would agree with you on that.
It's kind of lazily done.
Zero Mission, I think, was an example where it was more substantively different gameplay experience, even though it was essentially just a statistical adjustment, because it was so damn easy the first time that one could play it very thoughtlessly in terms of, did you really need to carefully observe attack patterns of enemies and kill them, sort of expediently or skillfully? No, because you could kind of stand there and take it because you had enough health in the energy tank left most of the time, and you had enough ammunition so you could just shoot crazily and all those sorts of things, so once you actually put those constraints on a lot more tightly, you did actually play it differently, even though there was just a statistical adjustment.
Right. People say that about Metal Gear Solid a lot, is that if you play it at the higher difficulty levels, it forces you to actually use some of the mechanics in the game
to actually
be
stealthy,
that you don't need to use, that almost aren't worth using at the easier levels.
Well, I suppose the one thing I'll say about Metroid Prime 3 in that regard is that I thought the actual hyper mode, when you go into the hyper mode in the gameplay, was more relevant in the difficulty called hyper mode.
Right, there's more risk reward.
Because it was trivial in the standard mode, really was. It didn't seem very meaningful, it didn't really deliver on the trade-off promise, whereas in the harder mode it did. So again, these kinds of simple things can make a difference. But the other thing I think that's kind of interesting is when you try to make different difficulties without just saying, right, this is what it is. And I think Nintendo have done that a lot, especially with the Mario games. I mean, because we've kind of talked about this when we did Super Mario World or the Retroactive and stuff like that. You can see the end of that game by playing some pretty easy levels.
By playing about half of it.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's all this other content that's quite a lot more difficult that you kind of discover organically if you want to play more difficult stuff, because it's more difficult to find in the first place because it's got secret keys and secret exits. And then the levels themselves are more difficult. So it's this very organic way. And I like that. I like the idea that people could kind of discover their own level without going, okay, which difficulty is for me? Well, this says veteran, so I haven't played this before.
Right. And the great thing about the Mario games is that if you're the kind of player who tends to be more thorough and really looks for secrets, you're going to end up getting into a lot of that extra content anyway, because it's not just all at the end. You can actually get into a lot of it quite early on.
As you go,
Right. So, I mean, if you're interested in sort of exploring and being very curious and getting into some of the more strange elements of the game and looking for secret exits and ghost houses and stuff like that, you're going to find that stuff anyway. not just at the very end. The other thing I think that, Mario does extremely well, and maybe some other Nintendo games too, when it comes to this sort of optional content, is that the appeal of that optional content is far beyond just being more difficult. They're not just like remix stages. They're not just the same stuff you did before, but more difficult. They're actually new content. There are new experiences, new enemies, new items, new level designs. Even finding that stuff is significantly interesting and rewarding. But then when you get into it, when you find the Star Worlds or the Special World in Super Mario World, those are worth finding because they're crazy and interesting and really fun and innovative and, you know, creative. And yeah, they're hard. It makes sense that they're more difficult because they're harder to get to. But that's not the main reason I want to go to do that stuff.
But because, I mean, sometimes you do get cases where extra content will appear on a selectable difficulty. Say, for instance, Contra 4 again, I think ends two-thirds of the way through on easy.
Yeah.
Going back to this idea of, you know, you've paid for the content irrespective of the difficulty level, you know, sometimes they don't see it that way. You know, if you want to see all of Contra 4's levels, you've got to go up to the harder difficulty, which
I'm not a fan of. I'm not a fan of that at all.
And then Sin and Punishment has more subtle but extra content in the hard mode, more bosses, different attack patterns for the bosses, you know, substantively different stuff rather than just statistical adjustments. I'm wondering how you feel about that, the idea that, you know, is it okay if it's like a little nudge to get you to try the harder mode, or would you prefer they just keep it all there for you to have however you want it?
Yeah, I don't mind some additional things here and there. I don't like the Contra 4 style where you just don't even get to play the last few stages.
Yeah,
because it is literally just at the end. Like I said, I mean, I'm okay with stuff like that being throughout. I'm okay having a simpler version of it and easy. I probably want it to be simpler. I'm okay with not having as many bosses. But I don't want to feel like I had an incomplete experience. I don't want to feel like, well, you got to the end of level 6. Oh, ho, ho, this is just the demo or whatever. You know, go play the real mode. That I don't like. So it's a subtle difference, really. It's not a huge thing there, but it means a lot to the player, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's a good point there. I don't really agree with that decision myself in the case of Contra 4. So, I mean, another thing I want to come to about this, I think, is kind of important in difficulty is, you know, what is it that makes a game's difficulty fair or unfair? You know, sometimes people might talk about Ghouls and Ghosts or certain parts of Mega Man or whatever, you know, if it's dependent on memorization or this, that everyone has their own different reasons. Well, that's Billy. You know, what is it for you that's like, play, say, an old 8-bit game, you play it's really hard, this, like, this isn't just hard, this is unfair?
I think it comes down to the point, exactly what you just said, whether it is hard or whether it is, you know, unfair, if a game is being cheap in its difficulty.
But what would you, could you distill what you think makes something cheap? You know, what is it, like knockbacks, you know, not having long to recover, like the no invincibility thing, you know, things like that?
Yeah, I think, at least, I think I'm seasoned enough as a gamer where I can tell when something is being cheap just to be cheap.
It's kind of a Miller test where this is clearly attempting to be cheap.
It's all context sensitive.
I think cheapness is something that developers don't go after on purpose. I think cheap. I think something feels artificially difficult or cheap when the developer has failed in providing those incentives that they wanted to. I think they set up these spikes in difficulty or these certain mechanics in a way because they want you to play the game the way they think you should play the game, or they want you to experience it in a certain way. And I think usually when it feels cheap is when they didn't really do it well enough, and it ends up just being frustrating.
I agree. It's probably most frequently a failure in execution, a failure for them to realize, you know, what they want to do. In other cases, especially in the old days, a cynical element to it.
Yeah, financial reasons, arcade.
Yeah, the arcade stuff. We're back to that again. But these days, I think, like you said, it's more often a failure of testing and stuff. And going back to Contra 4 again, I mean, that you see how people get too close to the problem on Retronauts. They were talking about the idea that, you know, they had been playing this one level with the waterfall and boulders coming down, and they were playing it, and it was like, this is ridiculously hard. This is just way too hard. We've got to change this. And so they went to the level designer and said, you know, we've got to talk about these boulders. And he was like, oh, yeah, they're way too easy, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, the people are so close to it. The people that are making it, you know, on that level are so close to it. It's very difficult for them to remove themselves. And therefore, to iron out all these things has got to be a collaborative process.
And I think experience also helps.
Well, and that's what testers are brought in for, too.
But then there's the process of interpreting what the testers are giving you and then reworking the level design accordingly. And that takes time and money and effort, and it isn't always going to happen uniformly. I guess we're going to try and get onto sort of the super guide issue with New Super Mario Bros.
Are we still going to have time to get to grinding? Because I have...
Oh, yeah, we're going to get to... Well, because what I want to talk about is, we talk about some of the different ways that these days, with so many different players, so many different kinds of players, you've got to have a load of different ways to tailor the difficulty given what kind of game it is. And yeah, grinding is an interesting thing because more RPG elements are coming into different genres all the time, and that's kind of, you know, Dragon Quest going all the way back in Japan is a game that was kind of, you know, that achieved mainstream popularity perhaps because you could grind your way to the top if that's what it needed.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember reading an interview or hearing an interview not that long ago, maybe a year or two ago, and someone was talking about how the whole idea of the early RPGs and putting in this experience gaining and leveling up system is that it would allow people who weren't very good at games to eventually beat it just by investing enough time. So it's basically a difficulty...
Yeah, a de facto difficulty slider, yeah.
Right, and I had never thought about it that way. I've been playing RPGs almost my entire life, and I'd never thought about it that way. It really piqued my interest, and I think what I like about grinding, about games with grinding or where grinding is possible, is that to me, a lot of times it incentivizes avoiding the grinding by learning to play the game.
Yeah, so better. If you find it sort of not particularly pleasurable, there's an incentive there to say, well, you know, what could I be doing better? You know, if it's an RPG and it's like a battle, like how could I improve my tactics to beat this boss rather than go out into the overworld and grind for another hour?
Right, so it ends up getting into, I think it takes RPGs or games with these RPG elements into a weird space where you think about, am I playing this really conservatively, or am I playing this really aggressively? Because in a lot of other kinds of games, those sorts of words probably wouldn't enter the vocabulary of how you play it. You know, there's a right way and a wrong way. And I think a nice thing about grinding is that it does sort of open up the possibilities of ways in which you can play the game, and it lets the player sort of choose. And there's not really a right way or a wrong way. Now, grinding, that word in particular has a negative connotation, and it's relatively recent development that people even call it that. We used to call it leveling up or whatever. And I think grinding in the negative sense really comes out of games where it's pretty much required. Like, the game just isn't balanced properly.
Where you can't choose your own approach to it. It's like, look, you know, it is just statistically infeasible for you to overcome this thing if you're not up to this level.
And then at the same time, if you have sort of a non-linearity in an RPG, what it means is that if the enemies scale up based on location, you can go to a place that's probably almost too difficult for you to do. But if you go there and are very skillful, or maybe very lucky, you can earn experience much, much faster there and basically avoid grinding by being very aggressive and sort of poking out into places where you probably shouldn't be yet. So there's that aspect of it. There are also games like Dragon Quest VIII and some of the Final Fantasies that have sort of side systems like alchemy or treasure hunting for really good equipment. You know, these other things that affect you, that affect your character development aside from pure experience levels. And so a lot of times there are ways where if you really focus your efforts in this other part of the game, you can really avoid a lot of grinding by doing something else. So they really give you a lot of choice, and that's one reason I love that kind of game, when it's done well.
But it's also, again, an organic kind of choice, the sort of similar to what we talked about with the Mario games and the multiple levels, because it's not like, you know, God of War, you're finding this bit difficult, aren't you? Do you want to, you know, it is nice and sort of organic and presents sort of trade-offs. It's kind of a way of expressing yourself in the game, essentially, how you want to approach it.
Right.
And I guess looking at where the super guide fits in, I mean, you know, we've looked at selectable difficulties, you know, sort of different paths, grinding, all this sort of stuff. The Super Guide's kind of a weird sort of hybrid of some of these different things because, I mean, in a way, how different is it really? Like having, just for the sake of explanation, having the computer take over and play through a certain section of the level for you. How different is that from, say, in one of these games where you can adjust the difficulty mid-playthrough? Just you're struggling with a boss, you put it down to easy, the health and damage stuff goes totally out of whack, and it's really easy for you to play through. Is it really that different from that?
I think Super Guide is a bit redundant in the age of YouTube, quite frankly. I mean, there is a difference in that with Super Guide, it is actually playing the level for you, so you don't actually ever have to play it yourself. But in terms of watching it, you know, I mean, they've said part of the reason for it, it's like not like the next level is going to be any easier, most likely. So part of the reason for doing Super Guide is that you get to see the computer or, you know, a recording of a tester playing it the proper way. So the idea is that you learn how it should be done, and then you take that knowledge and apply it in the next part of the game where you won't be frustrated. And that's no different than going to YouTube and watching videos, which you can do. I mean, within a day or two of a game coming out, you can pretty much watch a tutorial of it on YouTube.
You could argue that there's almost it makes more sense in that case that you just say, well, people could do this. Maybe they may want to do this. So why don't we just make it easier for them to do this?
Sure. But I think it's not as revolutionary as some people seem to think it is. You can already do this kind of stuff.
I mean, an important thing to mention about it is the fact that you do have to die 8 times in a level before you get the option to use it. So it doesn't just say, look, you know, you make your own decisions if you want to play. If you don't want to play through this at all, if you basically don't want to even attempt to play through this level, that's fine. It doesn't let you do that. You do have to make some sort of effort, or at least, you know, summarily kill yourself 8 times immediately to actually, to access this thing. And I believe, into sort of going, touching on kind of an achievement style thing, obviously we don't have an integrated system on Nintendo platforms, but there is going to be some sort of reward, I understand, for beating the game without ever using that feature at all.
Right.
Good.
Now, Billy, I know you're a big Mario fan. I mean, do you think you would ever use this Super Guide?
No, and if I did, if anybody does, you shouldn't even play this goddamn game. I'm actually offended, and I think that for any... and I kind of understand it, like, you're talking about the fact, like, oh, you could go to YouTube and figure out, you know, see that sort of thing, but the average person, like, the average soccer mom, parent, non-gamer... isn't hardcore enough to either A, go to, like, even know what GameFAQs is, or realize that you could go to YouTube to download a video to figure out, like, a strategy to get through something like that, or to go to one of the many different websites out there that do guides to walk you through parts of games.
Okay, but on that note, is that same person, is that mom who's playing it, going to sit through dying 8 times before she gets the option to use this? Like, it seems like 8 to me seems well beyond the point of frustration.
Yeah, it is.
Possibly. I mean, depends at what point in the level. Like, if it's really close to a checkpoint, maybe not. But if it's not so close to a checkpoint, the actual specific part that you're stuck at, then I think it would definitely be beyond the threshold.
I mean, looking back at Mario Galaxy or even Sunshine, like, both those games, just to get the amount of what you needed to do to finish the game, those levels weren't that difficult. If you really honestly go back and look at that stuff.
Especially not Galaxy, because it was so flexible. I mean, you had access to so many of the stars, you could just find ones you could do very easily.
Yeah.
Sunshine was a bit more restrictive. That made you do some ones that were kind of hard.
But at the end of the day, it really wasn't that hard. And so, in looking at the new Super Mario Brothers, like, I can't imagine this game... I mean, Miyamoto said that, oh, you know, this game's going to be difficult, but I can almost guarantee that whatever is needed to finish this game isn't going to be that difficult. And to add this sort of retard mode where you don't even have to do anything and the game will play itself, like, it really bothers me. Like, this isn't frickin' Wii Fit. Like, it's not supposed to be something... A game is supposed to be challenging. I'm sorry. And
it's interesting, so it's supposed to be challenging. You know, even do you think in this case in particular, because it's an old school 2D game, you know, this is not Uncharted, you know, this is not about storytelling, this isn't about
cutscenes,
you know, this is a pure gameplay game, if you like. And therefore, in that case, it should be challenging, is what you say.
Yeah, it's a game. Games should have some sort of a challenge function.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I tend to take the positive out of it, that the idea that maybe, by virtue of the fact that they have this feature in it, that they can make it more challenging, and for those of us who have no interest in using it, we are going to benefit.
Yeah, they've said as much.
The one positive thing I guess I could say about this mode is, if this is your first Mario experience where you've never played one of these
games
before.
Let's face it, they are going to hope.
Right.
They're going to hope that happens a lot.
You know, if you have kids and they're 4 years old, or, like, you know, they don't have the chops to beat one of the really older school things, you know, and this is kind of a learning tool for them, but I don't know. I'm just...
Well, that's another interesting case, because we talked about choice, and of course, you know, in society generally, we have a very different attitude towards the adult exercise of choice than we do to a child exercising choice. And, you know, is that the reason why it's 8 times, you think? Because, you know, they really fear that a child might very sort of irrationally just say, no, I just want to see the end, I don't care, you know, because...
I think children are more likely to bang their heads at it until
they
get it
right. Well, in certain cases, yeah.
The persistence of childhood.
If you're giving the... I mean, I know I had friends when I was growing up that I'd be around the house and play, and they would ask me to beat parts of a game for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what this is. You're just
and
asking...
And sometimes that's... You want to see someone else... Some people like watching other people play.
Well, that's true.
I think there's an element of that.
There's an example... I can't remember what game it was, but there was a game that had a particularly disgusting level. It was some old PC game that neither myself nor my cousin, who... was basically my best friend growing up, could beat. And basically, we were bringing in our friends who we knew played video games just in the hope that someone would, through dumb luck, beat this stupid thing. And eventually, I think there were 4 or 5 people in the room at this point just watching somebody else fail over and over again. And I think I was like asleep or something, and I woke up and came into the room, sat, like, kicked whoever was on the computer off, physically, if I recall correctly, kicked him off the computer, sat down and did it, and there was just this tangible sigh of relief that, in fact, this could be done.
The sense had been restored to the world.
They weren't literally just trying to cause physical dismay.
It was like that Takeshi's Castle game.
Yeah,
or
this wasn't an act of impossibility. It could be done. It was just the persistence of an 8-year-old who's determined that someone will beat this, even if it's not me.
Yeah, but is this kind of mode, is this too much hand-holding? I mean...
Nobody was having fun, though. I mean, this was work. This had gone beyond fun. This was about proving that, God damn it, this thing had to be beatable.
Yeah.
This ain't no game.
But at the end of the day, though, it's like you feel this feeling of accomplishment, and having this pussy mode... I'm sorry, I'm going to keep calling it the most rancid names ever, but, like, seriously, it's like, I...
When you've got this very separate thing where you've got to die 8 times, and then you've got to use this mode, you've got to make this choice, and it's in there, isn't the sense of accomplishment preserved better in that case than it might be in, say, the grinding example, where it's like, well, yeah, I beat this game doing it this way, but someone could have just done it.
My persistence did it for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the sense of accomplishment might be better preserved here, especially because they give you, you know, what is essentially an explicit incentive, like you will get some sort of stamp for doing it without using it.
One final thought I have on the Super Guide is that I kind of don't think very many people at all are going to use it. I mean, you know, we're trying to imagine who would this be for, and we're thinking, like, well, your mom, or the little kid who's never played a game before, or something like that, you know, like the really, really casual blue ocean type people. But to me, those are the people, if they play games at all, they're going to play the multiplayer.
Yeah.
They're going to be in 4-player, and the Super Guide is only for the 1-player mode. The people who are going to play New Super Mario Bros. 1-player are us. And we don't want the Super Guide. So it seems like they're developing it for an audience that's not going to play the game in that way, most likely. It seems all kind of a moot point to me, you know?
And also, I mean, when you put it in this 8 live stuff and all, it kind of seems like a bit of a last resort thing. You know, so it's not necessarily going to be something that'll be front and center. in the experience, I don't think, really. So, I mean, I agree. I think it's, you know, it's probably more been made of it than perhaps, you know, is particularly significant to the way you're going to play the game in reality. I mean, I guess what's more going to be interesting is when they extend it in the future to like Zelda or all this kind of
right.
stuff. That's going to be interesting because it's a little different in those particular cases. Because the thing with Mario as well is that, you know, a lot of the time, you know, you talk about going to GameFAQs or YouTube and stuff, but you probably know how you're supposed to do it. You just can't bloody well do it, you know, yeah. And obviously this does it for you. Whereas, you know, in a Zelda game, is it more going to be the fact of telling you how to do something? When they extend it, if they extend it into things like that, I think it's going to go into different territory. But I did want to finish this discussion with, say, one example from everyone of something ridiculously hard that they're really proud of actually say they have beaten. So, James, you first.
I think it might have been getting the gold medals, all of them, in every mission in Rogue Squadron, the original one. Because because
that's pretty impressive.
Because some of those are just, you know, like, you've taken a hit, you get silver. Enjoy it.
Yeah, they are demanding. It's a bit like Blast Corps as well.
Yeah,
I was just going to say that one.
Yeah, the fact that, you know, at the end of the mission, they tell you what you need to get the next rank. And I think the last gold I got, I missed it one time by, like, a minute. Like, it was, you had, like, 13 and a half minutes, because it was a huge mission.
Yeah.
And I had, like, 14 and a half. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, I have to do this. I mean, like, because I think I had, like, a ton extra kills, because I wanted to make sure I had enough. And if I hadn't gone on this, like, hunting spree, I probably would have been okay. So I remember I got it because I actually counted how many kills I had going through the mission so I didn't spend time hunting down extra enemies. It was a sad display.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there it is. I mean, there is no way in hell that if it didn't have that medal system, you would think, wouldn't it be interesting to see if I could kill X amount of enemies in 30 minutes?
No,
you know,
because,
no way.
Because
but
it's
then when they, but when they set you a goal and it's like, it's in this framework of other goals and it's like, so it must be achievable, but it's really kind of hard and all that, and you work to that, all of a sudden it takes on a completely different meaning. You know, Billy, have you got an answer for this?
You know, I don't know if it would say it's a difficulty, but when I pulled 120 stars out of Mario 64, I felt very accomplished.
That took some serious persistence.
Yeah, I never did it. I mean,
100 coins on TikTok clock or whatever.
Oh, that was a big one.
Good Lord. That it takes so long. You know, it's like one of those Rogue Squadron missions. That, you know, it takes forever.
And it's really not even that well worth it. I mean, you get the whole Yoshi sequence or whatever, but like... I just,
that's nothing. That is so trivial.
Yeah, but like, you know, I felt very accomplished. I played the shit out of Blast Corps, so I know I didn't.
Yeah,
I know
that's
I didn't
a great one for that.
Fully do everything in that, but like,
but getting almost any of those platinums was rewarded because they were super hard. Like one of them was with the little buggy thing. You had to do it in 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. It was so ridiculously hard. You had to be perfect, pixel perfect. Jolly, have you considered?
Oh yeah, I've got a good one.
Oh, I see it.
You know, but being that I don't have the history with Super Ghouls and Ghosts that you guys do, I'm going to go with finishing an old NES game, and I have a witness to this in TYP. I beat Mylan's Secret Castle.
Yeah, which is notoriously bizarre in its sort of difficulty.
It's quite difficult as well, but yeah, it is very strange game. It gets stranger as you go, and beating that game requires finding all kinds of randomly hidden exits and
that aren't hinted about. They're just there.
Anytime you had a game with a more open scope in the 8-bit era, there was always this opacity problem. You know,
right.
Like they couldn't really sort of lay everything out very elegantly or explain things. So,
and that game has translation problems on top of it as well.
And then, of course, you've got Simon's Quest, which told you the wrong things to do. Which is
yeah.
I guess if I was going to go with anything, I'd have to split it between two eras. When I was a kid, it was beating Castlevania. I was very proud of that.
Yeah, that's a hard game.
I got beaten into submission. Dracula just drove me nuts. It's a very difficult boss battle. But older is F-Zero GX. I beat everything in that game.
You got the AX cup and everything?
Yeah. And I mean, the reason why I was so proud of that is because I gave up on it for 6 months. I was like, nah, can't, you know, just too hard. I love the game, but some of this other stuff, you know, you're not going to do everything. And then I picked it back up and suddenly, you know, did one thing and thought, you know, let's make a run at it, and I did it. It is because it's such a good game that you can do stuff like that. It's such a really seriously excellent game, F-Zero GX, that I was driven to end up doing all those things. And when you hear, especially now with that you've got the internet, and you know, you understand, appreciate how hard everyone else finds it. You know, it wasn't just you. It really does add a sort of great layer of context to the sense of accomplishment there. It's like, wow, I did something that most people just aren't interested in.
I don't think you'll find too many people who've beaten Mylan's Secret Castle, but it's for somewhat of a different reason.
Yeah, it's like I said, because I mean, I don't know whether you've probably got as much affection for that as I have for F-Zero GX.
Maybe not as much, but I do like that game more than
most people,
else
more than
planet.
Anyone
yeah.
of sane mind,
probably. Yes,
because that
yes.
I mean, that's a game where it's not hard, it's not cheap,
it's confusing mostly. I can't wait till we do it for Retroactive.
Yeah, it'll
so
happen.
we definitely need to wrap up here. Boy, we can talk about games. So we'll have you back for listener mail right after this break. Okay, we are back for listener mail. The address, of course, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we're very pleased to catch up on a few emails here. Some of these are from a few weeks ago, but Billy's going to read the first one.
Yeah, this one's from Tom, otherwise known as Killer Manjaro from England. He writes, "Here's a video game shout-out for this week. I would like to give props to The Simpsons Hit and Run. For a Simpsons fan such as myself, this 2003 GameCube title..." He spelled GameCube wrong. God damn it. Whatever.
the camel
hey,
case.
I'm
thing.
Biased, but that still pisses me off to this day. Anyway, capital C, folks. I'm anal. So this 2003 GameCube title was the perfect recreation of Springfield. I spent ages just freely exploring the city, seeing all the landmarks and characters. There are little homages everywhere, from the vehicles and the surprisingly diverse soundtrack to the collectibles and even tiny figures of the scenery. As the cartoon was a big part of my childhood, this was a big deal to me. Even if the insane amount of fan service doesn't mean much to you, it's still great fun to experience the high-speed thrills of gameplay. Think Grand Theft Auto with a little platforming, a lot more comedy, which I know you guys would appreciate. The mission objectives probably could have done with a few more variants, but regardless, you'll enjoy it, and that's what matters most.
So, has anybody here played Simpsons Hit and Run? I've always heard good things about it. I haven't played it myself.
I think this is another one that falls into that category of, you know, I just don't buy very many licensed games, even for the things I like.
No, and you're yeah. smart not to.
And I love The Simpsons, or certainly did. But, you know, and I'm not a big open world guy, as I've recounted right. on the show before.
It was kind of a GTA-ish Simpsons game, but it did really, I mean, because there were awful Simpsons games prior to it.
And after it.
And, yeah, and after it, too. It did a good job with really recreating the world as far as, like, taking the license and using it properly, and I think that was one of the really big deals about this game, and that's why I think a lot of people and fans of The Simpsons and longtime fans, especially when this game came out, I mean, this is when The Simpsons were really still really, really popular, so it did a good job with it.
The thing that intrigues me about it is it's from Radical, and they're the guys who, after this, made Hulk Ultimate Destruction, which is awesome. Really awesome. Also available on GameCube. That is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Game to go pick up sometime. And of course, this summer they released Prototype,
mm-hmm.
which is again another sort of open world, probably less like Grand Theft Auto, but and more like Hulk. But you know, another one of these open world action games that it seems to be really their specialty. And you know, I haven't played Prototype, but Hulk is fucking great. I mean, I don't even like the Hulk character.
Well, he's not particularly lovable.
No, I mean, I've just never cared that much about about the Hulk, and I remember getting a review copy of it, and I was just blown away by how good it was. To this day, I have very, very fond memories of that. So that's kind of what entices me to say, yeah, I might check out Simpsons Hit and Run one of these days. All right. Well, thanks, Tom, for the shout-out. And, of course, we always welcome those. Now, Greg has the next letter.
Okay, so this is Dan writes, and he says, been a reader for years now, since the Planet GameCube days. The fondest memory I have of the site is in Space World 2000 Legend of Zelda clip of Ganondorf sword fighting with Link and being blown away and excited, before being let down by the series of Wind Waker announcements that followed. Despite the controversy at the time, I love Wind Waker and what it did with the Hyrule Legends and mythos. The ending was fantastic and even a bit poetic. I was extremely excited for Phantom Hourglass because of how Wind Waker dealt with having a Zelda game take place in the same world, but in a distinctly different time period. However, Phantom Hourglass left such a terrible taste in my mouth, for one, because it chose to ignore everything interesting that happened in Wind Waker. You could chalk that up to trying to get new gamers into the series, but why package it so much as a sequel when it has very little to do with picking up where Wind Waker left off? Same world, characters, art design, gameplay mechanics, etc. Ignoring the stylus controls, the gigantically glaring flaw with that game was the ridiculous Temple of the Ocean King. How many times do they expect the gamer to be forced to solve slash execute the same series of puzzles slash actions before they get incredibly annoyed, and in the case of a few of my friends that are long-time Zelda fans, before the annoyance of the repetition, which is under a time limit, mind you, keeps the gamer from even wanting to finish the game at all. And the game's ending made it seem to have very little continuous plot because of how unrelated the boss was to the rest of the world that was established in Wind Waker. Maybe I'm missing it, but it seems like these issues are never addressed when Phantom Hourglass is brought up. And Spirit Tracks is lined up to be the worst, because not only will Nintendo probably continue in ignoring the importance of where the Wind Waker world is and its history and its legends, including those of Hyrule, they're going to remove the most enjoyable part of Phantom Hourglass, the exploration on the seas. They're going to put you on tracks and force more limitations on the gamer's exploration. Why ruin what was so well set up in Wind Waker? Why turn the art style of Wind Waker into a blaring siren that screams, "Abandon hope, all Zelda fans who enter here"? Just looking for any thoughts on these issues, and hopefully not the kind that boil down to how revolutionary the stylus controls were. Different doesn't always mean good. Or even genre-defining or paradigm-shifting.
Well, well, first
off, long letter.
Different doesn't necessarily mean good, but they were good, so you're wrong.
I think they were good, the controls. But, I mean, I think Wind Waker was the most successful storytelling Zelda. And Phantom Hourglass did not really pick up on that.
No, but, I mean, if you went into a Zelda game expecting continuity from another Zelda game, where the hell have you been for the last 25
years?
Yeah,
what precedent has been set for that?
Well, but I think, look, I mean, when Wind Waker came out, I think a lot of people were like, I really love this style. But they expected that to be the only Zelda game that would ever look that way. And I think it was shocking when they showed one for DS that looked so much like the Wii game. I mean, we were blown away that they could get that art style to work on the DS and to work so well. And so I think it created a connection in people's minds that said, hey, this is going to be a lot like Wind Waker. And it's definitely not.
Well, I mean, this isn't even the first Zelda game that copied that style. Minish Cap had the same style.
Yeah, but it was more subtle because it was a 2D game. But yeah, it had the same character design.
There's one instance where it is explicitly a sequel, and that's Ocarina of Time Majora's Mask. But
again, it's very much, he goes to a different world.
Well, I mean, the fundamental story conceit of why he ends up in a different world is his horse. But if you follow the Ocarina of Time story, he shouldn't even have the horse yet. He's still a kid.
Well, let's not get into Zelda timeline stuff.
If you expect story continuity, these are the only ones that explicitly said, here is story continuity, and even then they didn't have any story continuity.
Stuff like the dialogue between the characters or whatever in Phantom Hourglass wasn't particularly bad or anything, like all the cutscenes and stuff, you know, they managed to retain some of that expressiveness of the characters from Wind Waker. With the art style and the graphics engine on DS, but yeah, I mean, in terms of the plot or the story, it's much more lightweight than Wind Waker, no doubt, and presumably Spirit Tracks will be like that.
Well,
again,
it's a more relaxed title too. I mean, at no point playing Phantom Hourglass did I expect the quote poetic ending, which I wouldn't call poetic in any way. than I expected from
a big sword getting inserted into a man's head.
The more savage ending.
I wouldn't say poetic. I thought it was awesome.
It's more when the water bowl fills in and all that is probably the more poetic part.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, I don't know. It didn't bother me because of this.
Well, the Temple of the Ocean King thing. I mean, most people probably have a great deal of sympathy with what Dan is saying about that.
I do.
Because I think a lot of people would find the concept to be kind of distasteful in the first place, just as something that is leverage or repetition. But I think, moreover, its execution wasn't particularly good within that. Anyway.
See, I to an extent disagree, because I feel like there's enough, as you gain items and abilities, you were able to jump.
There are some shortcuts in there. Yeah,
I mean,
the time limit is my main problem.
Yeah, but
also the stealth elements are really
I
bad.
Never ran into the time limit. Ever.
No, I didn't really either, but I didn't think that they went far enough with the shortcut stuff that, you know, there was still too much of doing the same thing again, literally the same thing, whereas maybe, you know, you could have extended it whereby, you know, if you now used, I don't know, the boomerang in a clever way, you skipped like three parts or something, you know, just...
I thought it was just under-designed. I mean, basically what you're saying, Greg, I don't think they went far enough with it.
I mean, as far as we know, there isn't going to be an analogous element in Spirit Tracks.
No, they've explicitly stated there isn't.
I don't think it's fair to say that Spirit Tracks is necessarily, you know, obviously going to be set up as the worst yet of the Toon Link Zeldas, because, you know, it may well... I think, as James says, you know, the basics of Phantom Hourglass of the control and all that were really well done, and perhaps this time they'll just make much better use of them. I could see that. It'd be perfectly feasible.
See, I actually object to the implication that there is the worst yet Zelda game, because I don't think there's been a bad one. And I think to use that terminology makes it sound like there's a stinker in there somewhere.
Well, yeah. He's being pretty ill of Phantom Hourglass. I mean, Billy, I'd be interested to hear what you think of Phantom Hourglass, because we've talked about it plenty.
And I'm a big Zelda fan, but I'm a big console Zelda fan. The portable ones, I just never, I don't know, because you play Zelda games for so many hours, and I never have had that much time to devote to a portable one. I usually will blast and just methodically go right through the console ones, and I loved Wind Waker. I actually think I reviewed it for PGC and I gave it a 10, which is the only perfect score that I've given a game. When I've interviewed Anuma, said, do another one on a console, on a home console, and don't...
You know, I was actually shocked that when the one thing they did show of Zelda at E3 was the concept art, and I was shocked that it isn't going to look like Wind Waker. I really thought they would.
I really wish it did. I mean, I feel...
Or maybe not literally the same, but something that might have been an evolution of the Wind Waker look.
Hey, you know, they've done the bait and switch with art styles before.
Speaking
of Space World 2000 and all that.
As we know now, those models were the Super Smash Brothers models, weren't they?
Yeah.
They look exactly the same, so that's what they drew them from.
Right, but that's why there was Twilight Princesses, because everybody went so apeshit over the Space World 2000
for the Super Smash Brothers models.
Yeah, they were like,
I don't know that it was totally reactionary. I mean, I think whatever they were trying to do with Twilight Princess, it probably made more sense to go with a more realistic Link, and also I thought they probably liked having the variety, and that's why I think they eventually will go back and do more. I mean, they already have gone back and done more of the Wind Waker style with the portables. I think they probably will with consoles too eventually, because I think they realize they've got this an asset that they can mix it up.
I think
the one thing I want to see from a console game that would use that art style is, you know, what you glimpsed beneath the sea in Wind Waker, which is the great expanse of Hyrule as interpreted through that design.
That was the only part of the game I hated, that invisible wall that was there that you couldn't
go through. you couldn't explore, because I think it just...
Such a tease.
It's so cool to have that vastness of Hyrule that you're used to seeing interpreted in a completely different way, the kind of crazy architecture that doesn't make any physical sense that you can have, and, you know, it's much more interesting interpretation, you know, compared to, you know, Twilight Princess, which is, you know, this big Hyrule field, but it still feels similar to what you've seen before. And of course, Spirit Tracks is going sort of on land, but being a portable game, the sort of three-quarter kind of view you've got, you're not going to get that. You know, that's something that sense of scale married with the stylistic flourish of Wind Waker is only something you'd get in a console successor, and I want to see that.
Well, this is what I thought of it at the time. It was like the Ice Key times 10,000.
Oh, yeah, the Banjo-Kazooie Ice Key, yeah.
Why the hell can't I get to it?
It's true, because at one point, I went into Wind Waker pretty blind. I avoided spoilers from the Japanese version on the internet.
Oh, I played the Japanese version, so I was very blind.
That's blind and deaf, in a way.
Yeah.
You don't know.
And illiterate.
Because, Johnny, you reviewed the Japanese version.
Yeah.
And also gave it a 10. As did Rick, making this the only game we've given three separate 10s to.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah, it was a popular game around the office.
But, I avoided all that. So when you get to the point where you get down there, I was like, holy shit, this is going to be it. Like, it was like a trick. Like, you actually do get to kind of, Order of Ecclesia. You don't have a Dracula's castle until like the secret second half of the game, where Dracula's castle suddenly appears, and then it's more like the other.
Hey, what's up, Dracula's castle here?
And I thought it was kind of going to be like that, basically, and then pretty quickly you realize it isn't. But it's still a great moment in Zelda history. That button.
Yeah. So let me bring it back to Phantom Hourglass here. This is a good point to do it, because my two favorite things about Wind Waker are exploring the sea. I know a lot of people would disagree with me there, but I really like exploring the sea and having that freedom to do it. And the very surprising links between the world that's established in the first half of Wind Waker and then linking that back to the stuff from Ocarina of Time and all the other Zelda games. Because you don't really see it coming, and once it does, you're like, oh, dude, this is not on a different planet, which could have been. There are all these connections, and it's not, it doesn't have to be continuous. You don't have to have a crazy timeline or anything.
But it's got callbacks,
Right, just to show context. That they actually put a little thought into the way the story comes out here. It's really refreshing, and it's really satisfying when you get to that. It kind of validates your love of the whole franchise. My problem with Phantom Hourglass is it doesn't have either one of those elements.
It seems like it'd be easier to connect to Wind Waker because it's carrying on the same
right.
characters, Tetra
and
all that.
Not.
And it doesn't, it doesn't attempt to.
And the exploration of the ocean I found to be very lacking in Phantom Hourglass. I think it's going to be even more lacking in Spirit Tracks, because you're on these linear paths. You're on the rail tracks, the railroads. I mean, we don't know exactly how all that's going to work out. I still feel like Spirit Tracks, I'm not anticipating it. I'm not dreading it. I feel like I don't really know anything substantial about it yet. But we do have pretty clear indications that there's not really going to be an overworld per se that you get to explore. And, that is always my favorite part of Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy, Zelda, Okami, Shadow of the Colossus. It's having this world and getting to explore it and being rewarded for that exploration in some way. And taking that out of the portable title is probably done for technical reasons, but it makes me a lot less interested in playing them.
Well, I think what you've got to do is the dungeon part of it has got to be absolutely impeccable.
Yeah, and I thought the dungeons were fine in Phantom Hourglass. That alone is not
to
enough
to raise
me,
the
though.
Game there in Spirit Tracks, yeah. I think, if it's going to really... Especially because the novelty of the controls has worn off and all that. They're really going to have to deliver.
So anyway, we need to move on. Thanks for the great letter, Dan. And James has the next one.
So Marcos writes, I would like to know what you think of Wii games reviews in general. I personally think most Wii games are underrated, and on the other hand, I believe most PS3 games are overrated. I own both systems, and it seems to me that most reviewers don't give high scores to a lot of good Wii games, like Little King Story. Also, a few interesting games that are not great, but are given good, but are good enough to be received at least an 8 are rated very low, like Deadly Creatures, for instance. And PS3 games or Xbox 360 games that are not doing anything spectacular, like Halo ODST or KZ2, are really overrated.
Killzone 2. I really want to hear Billy's perspective.
Ooh, boy.
On this. Do you feel like Wii games get the short stick?
Well, it depends on the outlet. Like, I don't.
Sure.
Edge might actually have a rule against giving an 8 or above to a Wii game. It might be a hard and fast rule they enforce.
I don't think that's true.
No, I mean, and I no, I kind of refuse to talk about Metacritic, but I mean, overall, like. It depends on the outlet. I know that at least, I mean, I haven't reviewed. I actually haven't reviewed a Wii game yet, so I haven't had to just because of the positions I've been in. But I think games are should be reviewed for what they are. It's not doesn't matter what platform it is. I mean, this person kind of seems like he's coming off like he's biased, like saying, "Oh, that games that don't do anything spectacular, like Halo ODST or Killzone 2 are really overrated." I mean, both those games do some pretty awesome things in their own respects. So,
yeah, I think Marcos might have a chip on his shoulder here.
I look at this as also, if you look at the DS perspective, you see some interesting things. If you look at some of these, I know it's not the most pleasant subject, but you know, these aggregator sites like Game Rankings or Metacritic, because I think what you see, you know, DS has this incredible range of games. No one would argue with that. It's got unbelievable software.
Yeah, almost staggering.
You know, one of the best that's probably been assembled for a console or a handheld, you know, in gaming's history. I think most people would agree with that. But if you look at the top end of these aggregator sites, they don't have very many titles that breach the 9 barrier, the 90 barrier. They don't have any titles that breach the 95 barrier.
For DS, that's quite surprising. There are plenty of DS games I've ranked.
I know, because you think, good lord, how many good DS games are there? And some of them are just seriously excellent and outstanding. And it's like, well, why is this? You know, and I think the reason is because compared to the big ticket items on the consoles, and especially the HD consoles, the things that are absolutely outstanding about those games, something like an Uncharted 2, you know, which is scoring incredibly highly, is that they are very tangible. They're very technical and inarguable. The graphics do look that good. I mean, you know what I mean? They are things that nobody can argue with. Everyone can agree on. So everyone scores them accordingly. Whereas when you move down to the lower tech platforms, that
it gets more esoteric.
That aspect that's sort of objectively verifiable is not weighted so heavily in the equation anymore. So all of a sudden, the opinions are not compressed together. They are more you know, varied depending on reviewers' tastes or whatever it may be. And so you don't get so many games getting into the very highest echelons of the thing. But that is a macro thing. You know what I mean? That's not because of bias. That's not because of some conspiracy individual gaming, you know, reviewers and magazines getting together and saying, we don't like the Wii, we don't like the DS, it's rubbish. You know, it's nothing to do with that. It's just when you put these things together on the aggregate level, you get these trends.
It is interesting though, because I went and checked out what you were saying, and I went to one of the aggregator sites and sorted by score, and the highest quote averaged DS game is Chinatown Wars, which is pretty unsurprising, and yeah. It has a 93, despite the fact that I'm counting something like 20 outlets that gave it a perfect score.
Definitely, I think a lot of reviewers probably give too much credence to sheer volume of content. And GTA 4 is a great example of that. There's just so much stuff. I would say there's too much stuff in there. And I don't want to get off on GTA 4 again. But there's a lot of examples of that where they really, you know, reviewers really, really like games where there's just a lot of stuff. And I think in handheld, and even with Wii, for whatever reason, a lot of times the games that come out on these platforms, they may be very finely honed, tight experiences, or they may be this kind of little gem of something that, you know, you've never done before in a game. It's really interesting, but it's kind of brief and not that deep or whatever, and it'll come across as maybe kind of a tech demo or just kind of a kernel of a game idea, not a complete game. And maybe that's some of it. I don't know.
Well, so in that sense, you might say you're agreeing with the premise of that Marcos is saying, to the extent that maybe some of these more objectively verifiable things, like, you know, the technical stuff or the volume of content, is overweighted in the reviewer's sort of matrix of things that makes the game good.
Yeah, I agree that there may be some disparity. I think that's what you were saying as well, Greg. I just don't think that it's as personal or as emotional as...
If there's a game that has a ton of crap, and it's crap, not just saying a ton of stuff...
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that reviewers like games that are very large, epic, comprehensive experiences, lots of features, lots of optional stuff to do, You know, it tells a big story, or it has a really robust multiplayer component. I'm saying reviewers like games that kind of hit all the notes, you know, they check off all the boxes. And I think with DS games and Wii games, they, a lot of times, even the really good ones are more experimental. They're not interested in checking off all the boxes.
Is that not the reason why so often, you know, games, like I said, we kind of talked about this last time, with, like, you know, Uncharted putting a multiplayer mode in, and, you know, Bioshock 2 is going to put a multiplayer mode, you know, they're playing to that that very
Metroid Prime 2
phenomenon, yeah. So, I mean, there's that, but, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that they're overvaluing it or not. I mean, that's kind of subjective. That's a value judgment.
From a consumer perspective, that's very good scale to use, you know.
If you're looking for the things that are going to score well across the board, it's going to tend to be the things that are just observable, that you just can't argue about, that aren't judgment calls. And those things are generally on, are most strongly on the HD consoles, because they have the biggest budgets, the most memory, the most graphical power, etc., etc. I mean, that's just, that doesn't have to be the product of bias, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think some of these are natural trends, and the best advice I can give to Marcos is don't let yourself get all worked up about it.
Yeah, and I mean, read individual reviews. I mean, that's a big, you know what I mean? Don't get preoccupied with this idea of how something is rated by everyone or whatever. You know, you find people you trust. It'd be nice if it was our site, obviously. And, because we aren't going to be systematically overrating 360 games relative to Wii games. Right. We don't cover them. So then, you know, just read those reviews, read the text, and then you'll see whether, you know, regardless to some extent of the score, this is going to be a game for you. And just for you, the rest of it is all the enthusiast point scoring.
Well, one area that I can really empathize with Marco here is that I can remember spending a lot of weeks listening to One Up Yours, or Listen Up, RIP, but I can remember listening to those shows a lot of times, and they would go 2 hours without mentioning a Wii or a DS game or Nintendo at all. Or even worse, when they did mention them, they would be like actually factually incorrect about a lot of things. They would be just totally uninformed on what's coming out or what this game is all about or whatever. And in those cases, it's not because I felt like they were being unjust to these other systems or whatever, but it's because I actually care about these people's opinions and I care about what they're saying and I respect them a great deal. And I just wish that they were better informed about some of the things that I care about. You know, like, I'm interested in learning more about what they care about. That's one reason I listen to them. I hope that's one reason that people listen to our show. But, you know, when we say things like last week about how someone writes in about a hockey game and says, why aren't there any hockey games that make good use of the Wii controller? Well, we found out afterwards, someone corrected us, that there is actually one that just came out that even supports Wii Motion Plus.
Yes.
And I had no idea.
Yeah, we dropped the ball on that guy.
Yeah. And in my defense, I'm sort of retired, but really, I mean, our show's called Radio Free Nintendo. We should be up on the facts about things like this. And I apologize to that listener and to all the listeners for not knowing about that. I mean, that's our area of expertise. That's what we should know. It's more difficult when you're doing multi-platform stuff like the 1UP guys were. But, you know, I can understand feeling a personal stake in it. And I know that the 1UP guys got a lot of feedback from Nintendo fans who said, why do you guys hate Nintendo? You know, because they would talk about it on the show and they said, we don't hate Nintendo. We just don't play a lot of Wii games because that's not what we're interested in. And what I would, you know, a lot of times I felt like, well, you might actually be interested in a lot of these if you knew more about them.
I also think at the end of the day, if somebody's supposed to review a game, they should know the full aspects of it. They should understand the game. And a perfect example is Wii Sports Resort, which personally I was not even remotely excited about whatsoever because I was so burnt out on Wii Sports. And when I was working for G4, we gave it a 5 out of 5, and I did not disagree with that review at all. And that's getting that score from G4 is not easy feat to do, and I just think it's up to each outlet's responsibility to make sure that they have the right people reviewing games. And at the end of the day, a review is also a review. I think Marcos, you're allowed to disagree with somebody's review score. I've worked at places where I didn't agree with the review, you know, agree with the score that a game got, but that's that person's opinion. Everybody's allowed to
And the point is, the source of that does not have to be due to some sort of systematic bias. You know,
right.
People just genuinely disagree about stuff.
I think when discussing, you have to have the right people editing games, that falls on, you know, it's the editor's job to sit there and read these reviews and decide, do they really justify what they're scoring a game? And if somebody were to knock points off a game simply because the system's power, I think that would come through if you read the text and try to match it to a score. And I think it would be the editor's job there to say, well, why did you score it this if this is what you wrote? Or if they do write in such a way that it becomes apparent that it's more about what the system can do than what the game can do, I think then it's the editor's responsibility to ask, well, why did you do it that way?
Right.
Well, bias, game reviews, always popular topics here on the show. We're going to have to cut it off there. It's time to finish up the podcast here. Before we go, I want to say real quick, announce the winner of the newest retroactive poll. Shining Force 2 Woo! Is the Genesis game we're going to be playing. And so if you're out there listening and you're interested in playing along, I definitely encourage you to do so. You can pick it up on Virtual Console for $8, 800 points. And I've always heard very good things about it. I've never played it at all, never touched it. So I'm excited to try it out.
I finally win one.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't win Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
You're not calling that a victory?
No, because we just
less
got
a victory
hate.
Than a defeat for me.
Yeah. Well, look, I finally win one post China Warrior.
China Warrior?
Sorry, not China Warrior. Oh, God.
That is a particularly cruel Freudian slip on Ninja Spirit.
Damn it, not Ninja Spirit, yeah. Oh, God.
So, we will be playing Shining Force 2, probably not starting it next week, but the week after that. So you'll have a couple of weeks here, and it's a strategy RPG, so it's a pretty beefy thing, so you might want to go ahead and get started on it. I know I will be. But congratulations to everyone who supported Shining Force 2, and looking forward to it. And, of course, before we go, I want to thank Billy. Big ups, man, for coming on the show. It's been a long recording session. I really appreciate you sticking around with us.
No worries. Thanks for having me, guys.
Best of luck in your next endeavor, whatever it is, even though you won't tell me. of course, thanks to James and Greg also for being here every week. We should have John back next week. I think, James, you're going to be out next time, right?
Yep.
Okay. I am 50-50 right now. I don't know if I'll be here or not, but the show must go on. We will have subs and whatnot as needed.
I vote for the John and Greg cast. I think it would be awful, honestly, but yep. In a good way.
All right. On that note, we got to end the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Send in your mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and keep an eye on the website, nintendoworldreport.com, for the official retroactive Shining Force 2 forum thread where you can discuss it with your fellow listeners and us. All right, that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, and goodbye.
Put it on your Netflix queue, but anyway.
Didn't you really just watch Crank 2 so you'd have conversation fodder with next time you see Jeff Gerstmann?
I didn't know he was a fan, but now...
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic.
Fan is not a strong enough word. I will
give Gerstmann a big
zealot.
Hug. Because that movie's... It's awesome. It's so bad. It's like watching Rambo. Like, the new
right.
Rambo, like...
Oh, I was going to say, the first Rambo is actually awesome.
Oh,
it's
nothing
awesome,
like... The First Blood, yeah. First
oh, no, but
yeah.
The
like
new Rambo, this, where there's just
the new Rambo.
Gratuitous
see,
blood
the new Rambo
everywhere.
Is an hour of abject boredom and 20 minutes of orgy, violence, death.
I like that we've walked into my wheelhouse of bad Stallone movies.
Oh, yeah.
This
oh,
is pretty
boy.
Much where I set up shop.
Oh, we were right there with you. Stallone.
So
I know a lot.
You'll love Crank. Crank is awesome. I couldn't understand why there was a sequel when the dude died at the end of the first movie by falling like 2 miles from a helicopter.
Yeah, it's fine. It'll be okay.
You know, and he's alive. I was like, really? There's a sequel? Like, how do you?
Well,
come
he had
out
a lot of
this?
Adrenaline.
Whatever. Anyway, all right. Sorry to.
We're good. It's
to,
okay.
To bore people with 3 minutes of my cheerleading crank. Too.
Well, we'll find a home for it somewhere.
Yes.
We're, somewhere
we're
in the
set
audio
for stingers now.
I mean, since we've essentially done a whole podcast worth of audio on late series Rockies, I think we can squeeze crank in there somewhere.
Well, best line in a Rambo film is, "Who do you think this man is? God. God would have mercy. He won't."
There you go.
I think I've mapped out my weekend now.